Another episode of the Joel and Blair Show. It is the 16th of May, 2025. Big show tonight. There's been a lot going on, and there's a lot to break down. But Blair, how you feeling? How you doing? It's to be honest, I'm not feeling 100%. I'm thinking about why that is. I'm not like fully sick. Like I'm not sick. But I got a little bit of like a slight sore throat that's been lingering for the last 2 days. And I was thinking, why is that happening? I haven't really been sick in a very long time. And then I realized that since the weather started getting cold, I stopped drinking orange juice. I was drinking a lot of orange juice. I love orange juice. But lately, I've just been drinking milk, water, Monster Zero Ultra, that kind of thing. But I haven't really been drinking any orange juice. And I think maybe my vitamin C levels have dropped. So maybe I need to get back on the orange juice. Maybe it's as simple as that.
Could be, man. I'm feeling okay. Since the cold weather, though, my lips have been really dry. And then this morning, it cracked right in the middle there. So, you know, I kind of look like one of those, you know, the death metal dudes with the rings. Like, maybe it's not that bad, but hopefully that heals up soon. I don't know why you get drier in the cold. You would think, I don't know, something to do with moisture in the air. I'm not looking into it. I'm just excited that the documentary, the first ever White Australia documentary, is now live. It's available for everybody to watch. I watched it last night and thought it was great. Thought it was an awesome first effort by the people who created the documentary. It was really moving, especially seeing the Anzac Waltzing Matilda march kind of woven into and blended into the present day march. And it was great to see things from the other side. It was great to see these boys for who they really are. There's so many characters in the group who are true believers, so much genuine passion. And you can see that all the boys in the group, these are the guys I know. This is the side of the guys that I see personally when I work out with the guys on occasion. They genuinely believe they're standing up for this country. They believe in what they're doing, and they are. That's what they're doing. So it was cool to see things from the other side. I think it was a really cool doco. What did you think? You were in the doco. You featured in the doco. So... What's your perspective?
Yeah, well, I saw a draft of it a few weeks ago, and I was pretty happy with that, but they made some slight improvements and made it even better. I thought it was 10 out of 10, perfect. I mean, so for those who don't know, there's a documentary that just was released last night. You can find it on the White Oz Media YouTube, Rumble, Telegram, or X account. You can find it on my Telegram channel. I shared it. Blair shared it. You could find it on Tom's Telegram channel. He shared it as well. Everyone shared it in the Australian scene. But it was a documentary made about our national meet over the 3 days around Australia Day in Adelaide earlier this year, which obviously made a lot of headlines. It was all over the news, the rally that we did. But it was actually a three-day event, not a one-day event. The day before, we had a 10K run and fighting competition, and the day after... we did a series of speeches at a seminar. So it kind of details the story of the 3 days. But I thought they did a fantastic job with the editing. It was incredibly entertaining, if I say so myself. And, you know, the quality as well was really high. I mean, this is just guys from the org. Like, this is Will and Ninja and a few of the Sydney boys in the org just put this together themselves. We didn't get any outside help. We didn't have any money to do it. They did it all with our own equipment, their own computers, and, like, you know, a lot of people were saying this clip. I'll just play this clip. A lot of people were saying this clip went hard. I mean, the whole thing went hard. But yeah, I'll play this clip because someone clipped it and I wanted to play a clip on the show. But you can watch the whole thing, as I said, on the White Oz Media, Rumble, YouTube, X, or Telegram. But here we go.
Have arrested many of our men for the crime of waving Australian flags, singing Waltzing Matilda, and being proud white Australians. Look at all these police, it's not even a protest, it's a celebration. There is a communist Aboriginal Invasion Day rally happening in the middle of the city with full permits from the state, full state sanction. Meanwhile, they cancelled the official Australia Day celebrations. There are no official celebrations in this city. There is, however, state sanctioned anti-Australian, anti-white Invasion Day protests organized by communists and Aboriginals. And we simply wanted to honor our nation, celebrate our nation for one day, our national holiday. And this is how we're treated, like criminals. This is an absolute outrage. It's disgusting. White man!
White man!
White man!
White man!
White man!
Anyway, obviously take it out of context, but it was cool. They kind of, the main thing that we've been putting out, obviously, are these kind of shorter hype edit type things when we do a rally or a protest or something like that. And what they kind of did was made like a 25-minute hype edit, I felt like, where they kept that kind of hype edit style. This was very dynamic, the music, a lot of changing angles. But the quality of the footage, the quality of the editing, very high. And everyone, pretty much everyone has had a positive response to it. I've noticed the kind of online Sook Brigade that usually talk shit about things I do or the organization do. Almost none of them said anything because they probably looked at the documentary and realized it was just too good to talk shit about, so they just kept their mouth shut. So that's how you know you really smashed it, when that happens. But a lot of people were saying as well that they showed the documentary to, like, you know, their grandma, one of their parents, or someone who's more moderate, someone who doesn't have necessarily the most positive view of us, and that it completely changed their minds about us, which goes to show that it only really takes like one genuine depiction of us rather than the bullshit depiction that's given by the mainstream media to win over, I think, a lot of people to what we are. Because I think what came through in the documentary is our authenticity. And that's why I think the system is so afraid of us, because we do have something quite kind of potent. And I think one thing that we've failed to capture in a lot of the things we've done up until this point in terms of multimedia is the, as you said, is the kind of energy of the group, the communal energy. There's a lot of you know, distinct characters. You know, we're very kind of like a very prototypical, I think, group of Australians of our generation, and there's a lot of characters in the organization, and people know, you know, me, they know Tom, they know Jacob, they see like Michael Nelson or whatever, do his TikTok videos and things like that, but they don't really see what, like, the group is like. And it's a very kind of like a potent and sympathetic thing, I think, when people do get that insight, which is probably why the last like three people that have reached out to us from major networks that have wanted to do a documentary for us, for the ABC or Channel 7 or whatever, why the editors have knocked it back, because they realized that if they did a documentary about us, that it would just make thousands of people sign up to the organization and make people like us way more. So anyway, this documentary was pretty great, was pretty good. It's already done almost 100,000 views in a day, so we're pretty happy with that, considering we've been so deplatformed, and we had basically no basis from which to launch it other than our Telegram accounts. It spread all over Twitter pretty quickly and things like that. So if you haven't seen it, go watch it and spread it around, show your friends, show your family. It's still on YouTube for now, so watch it on YouTube would be my recommendation, because it's a higher quality, like, it's less compressed on YouTube than it is on like X or Telegram or something. So watch it on YouTube for a better visual experience. And if you've got like a smart TV, you can get it up on the television or something. And very positive reception all around.
Gives all the boys representation too. A lot of the boys have been consistent in the activism. That's what it seems like from the outside looking in. And, you know, they are, a lot of the time they don't get a lot of glory for it. You know, it's boots on the ground, dutiful type work. But probably for the first time, that video demonstrates who's been most active, who's been most loyal, who's been most consistent and dependable. And that's really cool. Usually it's just the spokespersons who get all the recognition. But, you know, as I said, the guys all get representation. So this documentary that was put together by members of, is it White Australia now? Is that what it's called? Is what, and what is White Australia? This is my understanding is there was going to be a White Australia political party, but is this like different groups converging to form one community project? What is White Australia?
Yeah, White Australia is like the fundamental name of the entire organization. The NSN is the activist, is an activist group, which is a part of White Australia. And we have ambitions to create a political party, obviously, which is down the probably happening later this year. Then also there's the European Australian movement. I'm not sure if that's going to be rebranded from the European Australian movement to White Australia or not. That's more the community building aspect. The European Australian movement is about community building, but it's all interlinked. So anyway, you can find White Oz Media channel on YouTube. There's a link. If you're watching on Rumble live, there is a pinned message in the description from Nathan Swindon where you can go and watch the clip. So yeah. Oh, sorry, the video. So yeah, I think we smashed it with this doco. Did a great job, and I'm very proud of the boys who made it. And yeah, it's just another example of how our defiance, our collective defiance, both like the events of the actual Australia Day weekend, but not just that, also like our ability to kind of withstand massive deplatforming efforts by the state and continue to keep putting out high quality propaganda that continues to be interesting and continues to get views despite the fact that we're the most censored men in Australia.
It definitely was a very different picture to the front page of Adelaide newspapers, popular Adelaide newspapers, a different perspective than very Nazi thugs. I think that was the slogan they came up with. What's the newspaper called in Adelaide? I don't know. I've never been
to the Advertiser.
The Advertiser.
The Advertiser.
Adelaide's one of the only cities in Australia I've actually never been to, I'm ashamed to say. But I heard there's some great culture there. The City of Churches, they call it, down here in Australia. It's known for having some pretty cool architecture. And it's an historic town for that reason. I'm going to have to get over there and visit it, see it for myself. But I noticed at the end of that particular documentary, there was a recording of what seemed to be a conversation between two police officers, where one police officer was saying some pretty alarming shit. How did you guys, is that like legit? How did you guys come about having that recording? And is there more to that? What's the story there?
Yeah, so if you've seen the footage from Australia Day or from the documentary, you can see that when we assembled at the War Memorial, we were singing Waltzing Matilda, and then basically Tom started giving a speech and he was arrested about, I don't know, 20 or 30 seconds into his speech. So what happened was is that we actually rigged Tom up with a lapel mic, like a small microphone here, so that when we caught the footage, we had like a higher quality version of his speech for later content that we would put out. And obviously he was arrested. And then eventually they then grabbed the microphone off him and threw it in the squad car. So we've got a recording of the whole period of him being arrested and so on, a really high quality audio. We had someone there with a camera filming it. But then once he's thrown in the car and they took it off him, they just left it in the cop car. They didn't turn the microphone off. So the microphone was still rolling. The police then get in the car and they're following us around. They're making more arrests and they're talking all this shit for like over an hour. And we've got the recording of the whole thing. And they, wow. one of them goes, I've listened to the whole thing. One of them goes to the other one, hey, is your, because they've got their
body cam.
Yeah, they record audio and visual. So, is your body cam off? And he's like, yeah. He's like, you're not recording? He's like, no. And he's like, I want to fucking kill these cunts. And like, he just goes on and on and on for fucking ages about how he wants to kill us and beat us up. Wow. And he hates. Blah, blah. Anyway, we've got his badge number. We've got a picture of his face. We know who he is. We know who the other cop is. We know everything about them. And we've got a lot more where that came from. We didn't release it all though. And we obscured the voices in the documentary because we're sitting on it. It's a legal card that we want to play, and we're not going to blow our load too quickly. We don't want to undermine our ability to play that.
How would this information be useful to you? Is there like a potential lawsuit there? I know that you still have pending charges in relation to Adelaide and the protest, or not protest, the Australia Day march you guys did. You still have to go to court for that. Is that right?
Yeah, Tom and I have court on the 29th, so in about 13 days. We have court at the same time with the same lawyer.
Obviously, that's recording that you guys have. What comes to mind, the first thought that comes to mind is the court going to accept that it's provable that that is those police officers? Like, is that going to be easy to prove in court? Because they could just deny it. But maybe, I don't know, is there a way to prove that it's legit? Like, because I know that...
Yeah, we can prove that it's legit. We can prove that it's legit. It's not going to be difficult at all to prove that. We have the ability to prove it, and that's not the issue here. Look, what we're going to do with what our legal strategy is with it, we're going to keep the cards close to our chest for now. But yeah, they didn't know. They probably didn't know that we had that until now. They're fucking retards.
What's your opinion on why they had so much hostility? Or maybe it's not them, but this one police officer in particular saying that he, was essentially happy to murder you guys. Why was he so hostile? What's your opinion? Why the bias?
Well, so there are departments in every police force, every state police force in Australia. They used to all be called counterterrorism, and now they've taken on, in some states, different names. I believe they're still called counterterrorism in South Australia, and they are not counterterrorism. They are political policing bureaus that are staffed by ideologues. And they train their officers and brief their officers into basically being a communist style political police force in the vein of the Cheka or the Stasi, NKVD, these types of institutions in the Soviet Union, East Germany, etc. They basically propagandize that we are the greatest threat to Australian democracy, that we're terrorists and that we shouldn't have political rights, and to basically engage in tactical bending of the law in order to obstruct us from engaging in peaceful civic participation completely unconstitutionally. And so they're kind of brainwashed. And a lot of these Zogbot police officers, they're not that smart. They get brainwashed essentially into basically becoming, political police officers. In Victoria Police, for example, there is an entire squad that's dedicated just to the NSN. I know them from the fact how many times my house has been raided. It's the same people every time. And I talked to the other boys, and was so and so there. So there's a whole department of Victoria Police that's dedicated just to us. And when they come into your house, they know everything about you. They know all kinds of things about you. And I know you've dealt with them before as well, Blair. They've rocked up to your house before. They flex how much they know about us. And they try to intimidate you, et cetera. They basically see themselves as the arbiters of public morality. They think that they have the right to use the law unconstitutionally and completely illiberally in order to obstruct lawful and peaceful political activism. So these people are pure scum. They're either communists or they're effectively useful idiots of communists. And, they're pieces of shit, but people don't know that they exist. Australians don't know that this exists within our police forces. They think counterterrorism, they're probably making sure that, crazy Muslims aren't, doing car bombings or something. But no, like there's probably a division of them that's focused on that actually do actual work. But there are massive divisions of them that are focused upon so-called right-wing extremism. And the directors of these police departments admit themselves in front of state legislatures and in federal parliament that between 30% and 50% of their budget is going into right-wing extremism. Which means groups like us, not actual, there aren't terrorists. There aren't right-wing extremist terrorists doing terrorist attacks all the time. Like, you would be on the news if that was happening, wouldn't it? So what are they doing with all of that resources? What are all these people that are getting employed by these agencies doing? They are listening to my phone calls, your phone calls, Blair, everyone. Wow. They're following us around. There's weird cars that follow me around sometimes. There's weird cars I see across the road all the time. Like, they're fucking surveilling.
You want to be careful you don't get too paranoid. I mean, if they want to follow you, it's like...
I'm not getting paranoid, though, because they listen to my phone. Or they track my phone because when they have looked for me, without there being any basis for them to know where I am except by tracking my phone, they know where to find me. It's happened multiple times. So they're tracking where I am.
Maybe, but my perspective on this...
But we have to design our operations. When we do rallies, we have to design our operations with incredibly strict protocols in terms of operational security in order to prevent the police from obstructing us from even doing what we do. We actually have to operate at this really high tactical level, which people don't appreciate. People at home don't realize how hard it is to do the shit that we do. If we just talk to each other around our phones, not even on the phone, if we just had our phone around and we talked about what we wanted to do, the police would stop us before we got there because they would have an advance notice of what we're doing. We have to conduct incredible operational security. So the police are very far up our asses and we still consistently beat them in a tactical battle, which people at home don't realize. They think it's just as simple as showing up somewhere and pulling a banner out. It actually isn't. And as you can see on the footage in the documentary, you can see that we're arriving in small groups. Why do you think we needed to do that? Because the police were going on the news days before, and they were saying that we have intelligence that Nazis are going to be disrupting Australia Day, and we've got special powers, and we're going to shut them down and make sure that they don't assemble in the city. Number one, who the fuck gave you special powers? You don't have special powers. You're the police. You enforce laws. You don't make them up. They'd think that they get to make up the rules. Number one. Number two, what did they do on the day? They arrested people for loitering and possessing an article of disguise, which they said was a hat and sunglasses in their backpack was possessing an article of disguise. Ridiculous charges that have all been dropped now in court. So the so-called special powers they have are just making up bullshit laws, applying them incorrectly and arresting people under false pretenses. So this goes to show you what we're dealing with. We knew that they would do something like this. And they were trying to intimidate us. They arrested a lot of our men in South Australia in the weeks beforehand, put them on ridiculous bail conditions that made it illegal for them to associate with us, etc., to try and stop us. We did it anyway. We knew they were going to arrest us. And we go, let's get the Australian flags out, mask off, we'll sing Waltzing Matilda, and they can arrest us in front of Australia. And then we can let Australia be the judge whether... that's a reasonable way to conduct yourself. And all they did was made themselves look tyrannical to the Australian public, increase public support for us. And now they look stupid. All these court cases are getting dropped and we're going to sue them and we're going to try and get compensation out of these cunts. And we're going to then fund our operations through their illegal and bullshit actions, which are designed to illegally obstruct our lawful political activity. And we're now entitled to compensation and we're going to pursue that compensation. And we're going to go after other people too. Senator Hanson Young from the Greens going on television saying that we're terrorists because we caused terror because we marched down a street waving Australian flags, singing Waltzing Matilda on Australia Day. Are you fucking kidding me that we should be prescribed? We're going to sue that bitch as well. We're going to sue a lot of people because that's defamation. You can't say that kind of shit with no basis. And we're going to go after a lot of people and we're going to make a bunch of money in the court system. And we're going to then invest that in our political party. So thank you for the free money and thank you for the free publicity. These people think they can shut down our political activity by treating us like this. We've just used their tyranny to then facilitate the development of our political activity. It's a game of jujitsu. I think that they can stop us. They think that they can prevent us from politically organizing by making all these empty threats, like that we don't have any intelligence, that we can't see that it's all flimsy, that it's all backed on, by nothing, basically. No, we're smarter than that.
It seems like police command definitely might have underestimated the ability of some of the guys in the group to predict outcomes and make those outcomes work to their advantage. Because the first thought that came to my mind after watching the documentary last night was it really seemed like the police played into your hands on this one. I don't think Adelaide police needed to react the way they did. Probably it would have worked out. It wouldn't have worked out to your advantage so much if they left you alone. So, you know, so it seems like it's all been not only for nothing, but to the detriment of the State Police of Adelaide. But I've spoken about this, a couple of thoughts occurred to me there. But in summary, I've spoken about the phrase countering and counterterrorism, in my opinion, is repurposed counterinsurgency, and nationalist activists, particularly national socialists, seem to have taken the place of insurgents in Australia, or are classified as insurgents would be overseas, or like a rebel group. And the government develops certain countermeasures to prevent rebel groups overseas from gaining traction, popularity with the public, resources, that kind of thing. And countering, when it comes to intelligence or policing, is a very aggressive term. It doesn't just mean defending like it sounds like it means. It means a very aggressive and deliberate activity to disrupt and prevent certain groups, people from doing what they're trying to do, which is usually to generate public support. The most important resource for any insurgent group overseas, according to counterinsurgency authors that I've read, like David Kilcullen, is the people in the surrounding region. That's the most important resource, just like the Australian public, the white Australian working class, is probably your most important asset. They're the people you're trying to reach, right? So the process of counter-terrorism or counter-insurgency, which from my perspective is what the counter-terrorism department in Australia is going to, or is meant to, prevent you guys from appealing to the Australian working class, to paint you a certain way, to isolate you, to make it difficult for you to protest, demonstrate and communicate, not just with each other, but your message with the public. And so there's a deliberate effort to interfere with you on that level. But that's not legal in a democracy, is it? Especially if you guys are a registered political party, it's not legal to disrupt you from communicating your message to the public. That would fly in the face of your human rights and pretty much everything that our country is based on.
Well, the our constitutional rights of political communication, which is the essence of having a representative government, which is the fundamental provision in our constitution. They say that they're defending democracy. No, they're actually attacking a democracy. Everything they say is a lie and an inversion. They try and portray us as if, we're somehow, because we support and revere Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists historically in Germany, that were traitors to this nation. The real traitors to this nation are them. Like, they're the ones that are flooding us with foreigners. They're the ones that are basically destroying the political freedoms of our people to represent themselves. They're the ones that have sold us out, this political establishment, shipped our jobs offshore, that are basically cratering our way of life, destroying our quality of life and so on. We're the ones with the solutions. We're the ones that actually represent the traditional Australian nationalist point of view. And we trace back to World War II a lot of these problems because that's where you see the inception of this new world order that they're all signed up to, that's liquidating Australia. That's liquidating what it means to be Australian. That's liquidating physically Australia, the Australian people. The men who fought in World War I and World War II were fighting for a white Australia. There's nothing to debate. We talked about this on Anzac Day. Now, a lot of people try to then bring up, oh, well, I served in the ADF. I went to Afghanistan. I went to Iraq. Or a lot of them didn't even go to Afghanistan or Iraq. I trained in a field with the ADF, and now we're a multicultural fighting force. Fuck you. You didn't do shit. You're not a true Anzac. You know how many Australians lost their lives in the Iraq war? Zero. Do you know how many lost their lives in Afghanistan over 20 years we were there? 40. Two per year. There were twice as many Australians who died in the first 48 hours at Gallipoli than the amount of Australians who have died in combat since the end of World War II. Right?
Would that be... Do you fought any of these mean wars? Better at combat?
Sorry?
Would that be arguably because we've become better at warfare than we used to be?
Well, I mean, partly it's because, no, it's because we're fighting weak enemies. We were fighting World War One and World War Two against serious fucking enemies. We're fighting meme against wars.
Our own kind, right? We were fighting the world wars against our own kind, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. 65,000 Australians gave their lives in World War One. Why did we go to fight in World War One? We talked about it the other week. Because Australia wanted to ensure that the British Empire stayed strong so we could defend ourselves against Japan. And so we didn't want Britain to lose World War One against Germany because we feared the British Empire would collapse and then we'd be vulnerable to the Japanese, which was an expansionist empire. Explicitly, that's why we went to fight. That's why our wartime prime minister said, go and fight for a white Australia. Then in World War Two, so after World War One, I should say quickly, New Guinea was under German control before World War One. We, in the Treaty of Versailles, got New Guinea under our control, which is where we fought the Japanese in World War II. When Japan entered the war in World War II, they took Singapore without a fight. The British Empire basically pulled out of Asia, and so we pulled out of the war with the Germans. We were only fighting the Germans for a brief period. As soon as Australia came under threat and we realized the British Empire wasn't going to protect us, we pulled every single Australian out of Europe and North Africa and brought them all home to fight Japan, and then we fought a race war against Japan. So the majority of the men who died in World War II died fighting the Japanese to defend white Australia. We represent that. We represent that. These fucking scum are the complete antithesis of what those men fought for. We are the true patriots. They are fucking, they tell us, show some respect, get off the war memorial, like as if we don't have the right to be at that war memorial. We're the only ones with the fucking right to be at that war memorial, actually. And then on Anzac Day, it was interesting, at the Adelaide ceremony at that war memorial, they brought us up. They talked about how we desecrated the shrine with our presence 3 months ago and all this bullshit. They were the ones fucking desecrating the shrine with a fucking welcome to country at that exact same ceremony. So put all of this in perspective. Everything they say is a fucking inversion, is a fucking lie. But the Australian people, they don't get to see our side of the story. So, you know, it does work to a certain extent, unfortunately. It's not working as well. Less and less people are buying it. But if a documentary like that was allowed to go on Channel 7, we'd probably get, like, you know, 20,000 recruits in a week, you know, like.
It's so important, though, Joel. It's very important to get your point of view across to your audience because enemy media, enemy propaganda is going to be consistent. And unless your message is there to counterbalance the enemy's message, then ordinary people will just start believing what the enemy has to say about you. And documentaries like the one that was published last night aren't just great, they're actually essential. And you need to continuously, in my opinion, make not just docos, but short videos and content like that to reestablish a bit of balance in the perspective of the ordinary person. The ordinary person needs to see your side of the story. If they can't, they'll just side with the enemy because there's no other resource of information for them to understand your point of view, right? So the real job, like the activism is one side of it. Protests, demonstrations, communicating what you believe openly and publicly, usually for the purpose of spectacle or agitation. That's only like one part of the game. The real work starts when you get home after the event that you've just been engaged in. You need to get to work on formulating content, propaganda, to make sure your point of view, your version of what happened is presented to the public. If you don't do that, you're allowing your enemy the time and space to frame what you've done on their terms. And like I said, unless your message is there to counterbalance that, people will just believe that. So really good stuff. It's good to see the boys that are getting into making the content that needs to be made. It was a good doco.
Yeah, I thought it was a good documentary and spread it far and wide. It's going to rely upon grassroots promotion. But I think because it's so inherently good, you know, post it on Facebook in certain Facebook groups where you think there might be sympathetic audiences, spread it around your friends and family. And yeah, I think everyone who sees it that I've spoken to says that it was brilliant, basically. So I think we really nailed it. And yeah, there isn't much else to really say about the documentary other than watch it and spread it around. I think, yeah, it gives you like an insight to like the emotion of the weekend, which, yeah, puts everything in perspective if you've seen certain like things from that weekend without understanding the full context.
There has been a little bit of good news today, which is publicly available, so there's no reason why I can't bring it up. And that is Stephen Wells, political prisoner in Australia, who's been, you know, a big subject, a big talking point for the last few months in relation to the Adelaide protests, because he was arrested and detained. The police offered him the kind of bail conditions that he wasn't comfortable with accepting, which wouldn't allow him to freely associate with people with the same political persuasion as him, or of the same political persuasion. But he was released today and all of his charges were dropped. Interestingly, this happened the day after the documentary was released. I'd be surprised if it was a reaction to the release of the documentary, because
I don't think so.
Adelaide police would move that quickly. I don't think the justice system moves that quickly. But it's interesting, isn't it?
We know that it wasn't, because a few other of our colleagues, Ethan Hendren, Graham Connolly, had court dates earlier this week. Both of them were in the documentary, by the way. Ethan was the guy that was had a knee from the police officer in his back and was still singing along to Waltzing Matilda despite being arrested, which a lot of people commented on. And Graham is the Irish guy who was, having at least one Irish immigrant. Like, you're not really like a true Aussie group unless you have at least one Irish immigrant in the group. And he's our token Irishman. And you could see him, at one point in the documentary giving what he thought about what was happening while he was being handcuffed. We got good footage of that. So both of them were charged with display Nazi symbol as well as hindering police and refusing to cease loitering or whatever. All those charges have been dropped. They're all completely free. That happened earlier this week. So both of their cases happening before Stephen's, I think it made it clear that obviously they're just going to drop everyone's charges. They're probably going to drop my charges, Tom's charges, etc. And so every single day that they held Stephen continuously in prison, if they're going to drop his charges, just means more compensation that they're going to have to pay him for, you know, basically false imprisonment. So I think they just realized like every day they kept him in jail was just more dollars. So they let him out as soon as they realized that it was over. It just kind of so happened that they dropped the documentary at the exact same time.
Crazy they can hold someone for 4 months on charges that they knew weren't going to stick, and then they just let you out. They drop the charges, what, and like 4 months of your life is just gone. Surely there's some sort of compensation that Stephen Wells can apply for. Now, Stephen Wells is currently enjoying himself a steak, or just was recently. That's what I heard along the grapevine. He might jump onto the stream tonight. We might be able to get some questions asked, might be able to get his perspective, his ideas, and just his feelings about what's happened to him over the past 4 months. But I haven't had any confirmation yet. I'm just kind of waiting on a message. He might just be too tired. He might have a steak and go to sleep. The guy's been in jail for 4 months, and I can't imagine he was treated very well in there, given the attitude of Adelaide police towards Stephen and his colleagues. So we'll get him on, though. We will get him on, and we'll get his take on everything. But at this stage, I'm not really sure if he's going to jump on tonight or not. Hopefully, I'll get a reply. But does this mean that everyone's charges will be dropped? Because Stephen Wells had loitering. What else did he have?
Everyone that has had the loitering charge, all of their charges have been dropped. There's no active loitering charges remaining, I think, except against Tom, which I'm sure will be dropped. All of the so-called article of disguise charges have all been dropped. And the Nazi symbol charges have been dropped against basically everyone except Tom and I. So basically they've just dropped the charges on everyone, more or less. There's a few guys that have court dates between now and next week. I don't think either of them have the Nazi symbol charges. I think maybe I think they're going to get their charges dropped. If they're going to drop everyone else's charges, they have to drop the rest. They can't just like selectively drop against one person and not others.
It does depend on the precedent
is now that they're dropping everything.
If they think they have evidence to uphold display of Nazi symbol for one particular person, because they think that person did have one, maybe they'll take it all the way. But if they don't have any real evidence, then yeah, they will.
Well, they're saying no, but they're saying the NSM patch was the Nazi symbol. Well, that we didn't have.
Is that legally binding, though? Is that true? Can they?
Well, obviously not. They're dropping the charges, aren't they? So obviously they don't have a fucking case. They had a case.
Didn't they say you had an eagle belt buckle though? That was a Nazi symbol. So that was something
different. Yeah. So they're also saying that that is a Nazi symbol. So I don't know. Maybe they might drop everything except my belt buckle charge. I guess we'll see. But
the whole point is though that Nazi symbols shouldn't be illegal anyway. It's when you look.
Well, it's unconstitutional.
It is. So like you're basically tiptoeing around a law that is a bogus law in the first place. You have to obey it because it's kind of legislated for the time being. But hopefully there can be a precedent where that law is overturned because it's a symbol that doesn't actually mean what they want people to think it means. I mean, what does the swastika mean, Joel? What does that mean in essence? What's the meaning behind that symbol?
Well, it has a lot of meanings, but it's symbolic of our racial vitality as an Aryan people. It's also a kind of solar symbol. It's a symbol of, it's an astrological symbol. So it has multiple connotations, but it's an ancient religious symbol. That's what it is.
The understanding that the ordinary person, like when you look at the swastika, specifically the swastika as the German National Socialists used it.
Well, people think racism is
expected to think about the mass execution of Jews in gas chambers. That's what people think about when they see it.
I think most people think racism. And they probably think anti-Semitism. Those are the two things that they think. And yes, like those are two reasonable things to attribute to the symbol as well. I mean, that's hardly like the Nazis didn't invent the racial connotation of the symbol. The symbol's always had racial connotations as well. That's why they chose it. But that is why it shouldn't be banned. A symbol that represents our race. How dare they ban it? How dare they?
Well, they want to ban, like, they don't want your race to exist.
Exactly. They want to genocide our race. Exactly.
I saw a black pastor once. You might have seen the same video. I think he was somewhere in America. And he was explaining that the swastika is actually a symbol of the sun. Because if you look at it, there's four right angles. And a right angle is 90 degrees. And multiplying 4 by 90 gives you 360, which is a perfect perfect circle. So the swastika is another way of drawing a perfect circle, mathematically speaking. And that is the symbol of the sun or the life giver. But as you said, there's all sorts of different interpretations around the swastika. I know that Hindus,
definitely is a solar symbol. That's definitely true.
Religions all around the world use it for their specific purposes. But obviously there's, exemptions or... subsections of the legislation which allow it to be used for foreign religious purposes. It's just not allowed to be used by white guys in Australia, basically. That's what the law basically says, which is bullshit. Yeah.
And you're even allowed to use it if you're a leftist who's mocking us. You just can't use it if you like Nazis or you like white people.
If you actually believe it has some sort of meaning pertaining to your ethnic identity.
Anyway, we didn't have a swastika on us. We weren't displaying swastikas because we are fighting that, but we don't want to just keep getting arrested for displaying swastikas all the time. That's obviously unproductive. So we don't display swastikas. In fact, the NSN logo was not a swastika to begin with.
You know what's funny? Since they brought in the laws banning Nazi salutes and Nazi symbols, very few people who are actually true believers or National Socialist activists have actually been charged. Most of the people who get charged for it are just people doing it as a joke or just to stir shit up or because they don't even understand the real meaning behind it. There's even people who have been arrested locally down where I live, an hour out of the city, because they've been doing it in public and they're just, drunks on the street or something. So the whole point of the law was to try to curtail a political ideology, but it's just keeping the police busy rounding up troublemakers who don't even understand what they're doing or why they're doing it. They just know that this creates a reaction and it's entertaining for them. But obviously there's been a couple of activists who have been charged. Jacob Hersant, the head of the NSN, he's still fighting in court against a charge for raising his arm up in the air. Maybe he didn't even do it properly. I think he did a half salute or something. How's that going? What's the progress there? Has he been back to court yet?
I think I want to say July he's going to go before the county court. I could be mistaken, but it's soon. It's coming up. But whatever happens at the county court, I believe if he wins, I think the state will appeal it. And I think if he loses, I think he'll appeal it. So I think either way, it's likely to then go to the Supreme Court of Victoria. And then the same thing. I think if he loses or if he wins, again, either side will appeal it. And it will probably end up in the High Court of Australia. So I think we're looking at a very long process there where it'll kind of go up the courts, you know, piece by piece. And so we're probably looking at like a year until it gets to the High Court, at least the way that all these legal machinations work. But I do think that the constitutional case is very strong and that he has got very solid grounds to win that ultimately. And what a moment that will be if we can have a victory in the High Court, because that'll knock out not just the Nazi salute ban, but also Nazi symbol bans and so on. It will have ramifications for multiple laws around the country if he wins. Imagine the boys at Canberra at the High Court walking out after a victory and we can all throw, you know, Roman salutes to the media. And the Roman salute can become a symbol of political freedom in this country, which would be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, well, anything's possible, especially when it comes to, you might say, introducing or even reintroducing new cultures, countercultures into the current culture. It might seem like it's impossible to get people to accept the Nazi salute or the Roman salute as a popular counterculture thing. But you would have said the same about feminism 100 years ago. People would have said the same thing about atheism 200 years ago. They never thought those things would fly with the public. They never thought they would be part of any sort of popular social culture. But things tend to go through a couple of stages when you're trying to introduce or reintroduce a socially unacceptable concept or gesture. First, people just ignore it. They don't even care about it. Then they start to notice it and they get a little bit annoyed by it. But then they begin to just accept it as part of their regular life. Those are the stages that new things you're imposing on a society seem to go through. And I think it was Napoleon who summarized it that way too. But I just sent you a couple of articles or a couple of links because it's a subject that I wanted to segue onto. And I'm not sure whether you want to hit that subject yet or not. Let me know. There's just a couple of articles about a story which really grabbed my attention for a couple of reasons that I'll get into once we get into the story. What the story was.
Well, let me read the news article out and then we'll get your take. I'll read the notices article on it.
I was just going to summarize it before you start reading.
Wait a second. Let's park it. I believe we've got Stephen Wells.
Really? In. Okay. Yeah, cool.
Okay, maybe he's having issues. Oh,
we could talk about this while he's getting set up.
We can touch on it while he's getting set up. So here we go. Here's the article. I'll pull it up. So this is from Notice earlier in the week.
Just one second.
24-year-old woman set male friend on fire because he joked that she should stay in the kitchen. This is the victim and the perpetrator. She's definitely got that crazy bitch expression. A woman who set a lifelong male friend on fire, leaving him with horrific injuries, has told a court she did it because of a, quote, misogynistic comment. Corby Walpole, 24, doused Jake Loader in petrol and set him alight in How Long, New South Wales, on January 7th last year after he joked that she should stay in the kitchen and make scones instead of drinking with the boys, Albury local court heard on Thursday. The pair, who had grown up together and were both aged 23 at the time, were drinking at her home when she poured the fuel over him from a jerry can and ignited it with a cigarette lighter, causing burns to 63% of his body, the Border Mail reported. He was in an induced coma for 10 days, spent another 74 days in a burns unit, required 10 surgeries, and can no longer go in the sun, and has trouble regulating his body temperature as his sweat glands have been burnt off. Mr. Loader did not attend court, but prosecutor Max Pincotts read a victim impact statement where he said the attack had left him scarred for life and his parents, quote, emotionally wrecked, constantly worried about my well-being. This was not a single event with a single victim, he said, as family members wept. The damage reaches into my future and into the lives of those who care about me. She told the court the perpetrator, that she felt, quote, horrible, remorseful, and guilty for what I've done to Jake, not only Jake, but his family, his loved ones, our mutual friends, anyone involved in this case, and that Jake didn't deserve what happened. She told the court that he had been pushing her buttons, but under questioning admitted they frequently made fun of each other and engaged in banter. He told me to go to the kitchen where I belong because I'm a girl. I gave it back to him and called him a misogynist, she said. When asked why she had committed the crime, she said she, quote, didn't know, and that she, quote, didn't want to injure Jake. Mr. Pincott told the court that Walpole, who in December pleaded guilty to one charge of burning or maiming by using a corrosive fluid, should be jailed because she was not provoked and had time to reconsider before setting the petrol alight. She could have walked away at any point, but she did not, he said. She had ample opportunity for her anger to cool. But Walpole's lawyer, Peter Neal, claimed his client was a, quote, sick young woman who had been suffering with her mental health at the time and now has PTSD from the incident, and argued for an intensive corrections order. He told the court Mr. Loader had, quote, pushed her over the edge, and that the incident was exacerbated by her abuse of alcohol and cocaine, caused by a relationship that left her feeling depressed and trapped, ABC News reported. Judge Jennifer English adjourned sentencing until May 22nd, saying she had a lot to consider. She also has a previous assault occasioning actual bodily harm over a 2021 attack on a bouncer, which she also avoided jail for. So basically her lawyer is arguing that she shouldn't go to jail for dousing this guy in petrol, who was her supposed friend, and fucking almost burning him to death, leaving him in a coma for a week and a half.
All right, now. All right, I need to interject. Stephen Wells, we'll get back to the article in a minute. Stephen Wells is apparently trying to enter the waiting room through a mobile phone. And you need to...
Well, he was here, then he left. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, he should be going back in now. I think because someone just tried to give me a call to let me know, and I think they're using the same phone that he's got. You sent him the link to get into the stream. Is that right?
Yeah. All right, I see him. Here he is. Hello. How you going, Stephen?
Hey, Stephen Wells, mate, you have been talk of the town for the past few months, and you're looking like you've grown a bit wild there, my friend. You've grown a bit wild. How are you feeling?
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah, I decided I was going to come out as Nazi Gandalf. I wasn't able to shave the first week, and then they were only offering Manky razors, so it was never going to get through the beard, so I thought I'll just let it grow. So yeah,
you're looking wise, mate. You're looking wise.
When you're arrested, you look like Hitler, and now you look like Santa Claus. So it's full spectrum on the Odin, because Tom Sewell always said that Hitler and Santa are like two manifestations of Odin. So you kind of gone from one to the other,
and Stephen Wells is the third. Mate, what was it like? It must feel so good to be out. Where were you being held for the majority of the time?
So the majority of the time I was in a dry cell, in a punishment cell in the remand center. So in Unit 7, for anybody who's familiar with it, which is basically the cell for the worst offenders of the worst offenders. So I had I wanted to go to the toilet. I had to ask the prison officers to flush the toilet for me because I couldn't flush my own toilet. I also had to ask for a shower if I wanted a shower. And then the last 3 weeks, they decided that solitary confinement wasn't forcing me to take the bail conditions. So they transferred me to Yatala labor prison and stuck me in a punishment cell with somebody accused of... attempted murder and arson, but he turned out to be a pretty good guy. So that backfired on them as well. The last 3 weeks I've been in the general population along with the murderers and the rapists and all the rest of it. So it was quite a surprise to be let out today. I was wondering whether I would beat Sewell in terms of his 210 days on bullshit charges, but I'm out in just over half the time, so I'm very happy.
Hey, second comes right after first, mate. You still did pretty well. And, well, I got to say, it's commendable that you took a stand, because you had the opportunity to accept some pretty bad bail conditions that wouldn't allow you to freely express yourself, and you were like, no, I'm not doing that. I'll stay in jail until they're going to let me out free. And you proved your point. they've let you out free. But did you receive any particular harsh treatment in there? Was anyone particularly unfair to you, any of the officers?
The first week was pretty difficult, but mainly because I was so pissed off at the way the police had treated me. And they tried to railroad me into the system when I came into the remand center. And about an hour before, they'd stolen the shirt off my back, and I was just in a fucking foul mood. So I refused to wear the prison uniform for the first week. And so that caused a bit of an issue. And then I'm on a carnivore diet, and so I refused to eat any of the slop that they gave me. And they refused to give me anything on the carnivore diet for the first week. So first 7 days, I went hungry, didn't get anything to eat at all. They kept offering me the slop, and I kept saying no. And then on the morning of the seventh day, one of the managers basically said, look, you're either going to eat the slop or eventually we're going to force feed you and treat you as a hunger striker. And that was a pretty low moment. But later that afternoon, another manager on the night shift, he was worried about duty of care, and he finally got me some boiled eggs, which they could have got me on the first day. So that first week was pretty rough. But once I'd managed to get the concession on the prison uniform from the head of the prison, and finally got my diet, they finally got them giving me some boiled eggs, then I was willing to give them the respect that they'd failed to give me on the first week, and then it got a bit easier. So other than that, no, I mean, I'm pretty easygoing and pretty respectful to just about everybody. And I mean, it's pretty strong on the diversity hire in the remand center, particularly in terms of the officers and stuff. But I've never actually had a problem with individuals for, you know, their skin color or their religion or anything else. It's just more the government policy that's pissed me off, because I know that, you know, regardless of how tolerant I am, that makes no bloody difference when it comes to national policy. So, you know, and I was basically expressing that view to all of the diversity hire that was in there. And they all treated me pretty well because I treated them well, because I've got nothing against them personally. I just know that if the government keeps bringing them into the country, that eventually there's going to be, you know, it's going to be Bosnia, and I don't want Bosnia in Australia. So, you know, expressing that view, and they were like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And so, turned a lot of the prison officers around and got a lot of respect in the remand center before they sent me to Yatala. Yatala was a bit different. There, they're just a bunch of goons. I didn't get to speak to any of the prison officers at all. It's just all regimented. It's like, being in a military prison, you know, you wake up, you've got to have your bed made, you've got to be standing at attention when they come and get you out. They don't speak to you. They send you into the yard or the communal area with all of the other prisoners.
So there's, and then there's no pleasantries in an environment like that. I know that most prisons are supposed to be run like that, but the screws, the prison officers, they tend to just take it easy most of the time, and it's not always that bad. But what's astounding to me is you were just under four months ago, at an Australia Day march with Australian flag. You're arrested, charged with loitering.
Yeah.
And then they put you in a punishment cell for 4 months with people who have committed serious indictable offences like attempted murder and arson. That's incredible. I suppose you're really happy to be out. It must feel amazing to be out. But once that feeling wears off, I can imagine you'll be pretty angry. You'll be pretty frustrated. What's your? Do you have a plan? What are you going to do from here?
I really don't know. I mean, the thing is, and what people really need to realize, because they do this sort of stuff to people to try and intimidate everybody else into not making a stand, because if I make a stand, what if they treat me like Stephen Wells? What if they treat me like Tom Sewell? I don't want to go to prison. I don't want to do all the right thing else. And to all of those people who are scared because of what they think the government might do to them, I want to say to you that whatever they've done to me, it's nothing compared to what I've got back. It's nothing compared to the self-esteem that I've received, to the spiritual uplift that I've received. You know, especially anybody who's religious and has got a Christian background, you know, the Bible really comes alive when it says, blessed are those who are persecuted for my sake. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. You cannot understand just how true those words are until you make a stand on principle and get punished for something that you know you shouldn't be punished for. Despite all of the shit, despite the fact that I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, I am so happy and glad and blessed to have been through this experience. I cannot tell you just how good it is and how wonderful I will feel on my deathbed, whenever that will be, to look back on this moment and remember taking a stand, not knowing whether it was going to achieve anything. In fact, expecting that it was going to achieve absolutely nothing at all. Because that's the other thing that holds people back, is you think, yeah, well, I could do something, but nothing's going to change. And maybe nothing will. But something changes inside you that I can't describe. It is just an amazing feeling to stand for what you believe in, regardless of the consequences, and to face persecution knowing that you're right, and to withstand it. You and I both did the push-up challenge in November, Blair, yeah?
Yeah.
With Mark Collette, yeah?
That's right,
It's like that. It's like that push-up challenge was a fucking cunt, and I, you know, Mark Collette deserves a punch on the nose for making me do it. but I'm 56 years old. Well, at the end of that push-up challenge, I was expecting to be all muscled up and be fit and happy and all the rest of it, but I wasn't. At the end of that push-up challenge, I was fucked. I was fucked for a month. My everything was buggered. My limbs were buggered and everything else. I didn't get anything.
Too much. You can't do that every day. It's actually too much. That's why. But what you're saying is it was worth it because you proved to yourself that through commitment, through a bit of self-pride, you stood up and did not compromise. You didn't compromise with yourself on the deal you made with yourself that you weren't going to give up. And it's the same feeling here, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So either you come out as a religious point and you understand what the Bible actually means doing something like that, or if you're into weights and then you're into training and stuff, it's exactly like that, but better. It's like everything you've ever done in the gym magnified, you know, 100 times, because it's not just physical that you're doing, it's mental, it's spiritual. And you go through something like that, and it is the most amazing experience you can ever go through. So anybody who is holding back because they think, I don't want to go through something like that, I don't want to risk something like that, I don't want to risk my finances, I don't want to risk my job, I don't want to risk my house, I don't want to risk going in jail, I don't want to risk not seeing my wife for so long. Yeah, it's fucking horrible. Just like going to the gym can be fucking horrible when you haven't done it for God knows how long. But God, I tell you, it is brilliant. It is just the most spiritual and uplifting thing I have done in my entire life. And yes, I want to get the bastards back for what they've done to me. But at the same time, they couldn't have done more for me. They think they were trying to break me. They weren't. They were building me up. They were making me into a man that I've never been in my entire life. And so fuck you, Chief of Police of South Australia. Fuck you, the Premier. Fuck you, the guys who arrested me. Fuck you, the prosecution. And fuck the magistrates who you just do things because it's what they always do. Fuck them all. Because at the end of the day, not only did you not break me, you built me into something better, something that I never thought I would be, and it's backfired on them spectacularly. Even if nothing happens outside of what's been done to me, they have just made me proud and happy to be alive and grateful for my life, and made my life actually mean something. It's been wonderful.
Powerful message, mate. Really powerful message, and very well said. I think that's a really important point to put out there, because you're right. The reason they did what they did to you was to try to break others, to try to whip others into line. But you're saying it was all worth it, and so it should have the reverse effects. I want to send out a big thanks to everyone who supported Stephen Wells, who donated to the legal fund to help him out, to help out his wife. Have you spoken to the wife? How's she going?
Yeah, she's on a flight straight over. So I'll be meeting her in a couple of hours. And yeah, I can't wait. That's been probably the only thing that's been close to breaking me. Because
let me just say, mate, she has been absolutely relentless in her efforts to help you. Every minute of every day, she was dedicated to doing everything she could for you. I haven't seen anything like it. I've never seen dedication like that. All the guys were noticing, understanding her commitment. So you've got a solid wife there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she wanted me home. And about 4 weeks in, she was begging me to come home. And that was the closest it came to breaking. But I said to her, you know, honey, if I come home, it's not going to be me that comes back, you know. It'll be somebody else. It'll be... it'll be a broken man that comes back if I come back now. So please don't ask me to come back because you're my one weakness. You're the only thing that can break me. And thanks to God, she chose to sacrifice as well and not have me home because she knew if I'd come home, it would have just been a shell. There'd have been no Stephen Wells left. But there's going to be more Stephen Wells coming back to her than left her. There's going to be Stephen Wells on fucking steroids, mate. So, yeah.
Amazing, mate. Like, it's an amazing message. You are genuinely... I can see that you have a genuine passion and a genuine belief for what you're standing up for. And the sort of sacrifice you've made here is tremendous. And let it be an example. Let it be an example to everyone that they can only make you stronger. Everything they do to you, it can only make you stronger. It strengthens our resolve and it builds our community stronger. It builds respect. It builds strength. It builds endurance, perseverance, the kind of stuff that we need as a community to survive for all of time into the future. So awesome stuff, mate. Like, you've led by example. And anything you want to ask Joel or add?
I just want to say, Joel, I didn't get to meet you and shake your hand properly at the Nationals. And you've had my respect for a long time, mate. And, I look forward to meeting you in person and probably shaking your hand and getting to know you better, mate.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I'll be able to see you at the next one, hopefully now. Obviously, you'll be free, so that'll be great. But, I just want to say quickly, everyone else signed those bail conditions, they were presented to me as well. I looked at it practically. And thought, well, you know, it sucks, but if I sign these, I'll be able to, you know, advocate, organize lawyers, et cetera, easier on the outside than the inside and blah, blah, blah. I looked at it like in a pragmatic way. But there was a piece of me that wanted to just go, fuck you and do what you did. And I cucked out because, I had to think practically. But it was admirable. It was admirable that you were the only one who did that, actually, because even Tom almost did it. And then he ended up... signing the conditions at the last minute. But it was admirable that you actually had the balls to go, nah, fuck you. I'm just going to like stand on principle. And I just hope that you get a fat compensation payout from it because you deserve it. And also it's been inspirational to everyone because the reality is people have already done jail time for this movement. You know, you mentioned Tom, others as well in the organization have done jail time for the movement. And it's going to happen in the future probably. A lot of us are probably going to have to do more jail time for the movement. And your example does, I think, go a long way to eliminating the fear perhaps that many have of that or the trepidation and gives people a lot of courage to be emboldened that it's nothing to be afraid of and actually just to kind of stand staunch and keep pushing forward with this movement because every time the system does things like this to us, all it does is actually improve our reputation in the community, actually. I think that's the thing about Australians. This is a fucking prison colony. Sending folk heroes to jail doesn't make the people like them less. It makes people like them more. Like, that's what these people don't fucking realize.
That's true. So, I reckon, have you had yourself a steak, Stephen?
Yeah, I've, Tom's treated me to a tomahawk, a 1.4 kilo steak. Yeah. And I was wondering if I would actually be able to eat it after being on such a starvation diet for a while, but I've actually devoured the entire thing. So yeah, I've lost, probably about 15 kilos in 16 weeks, through the, malnutrition of the prison. But I've put back at least 1.4 kilos on in the last hour. So, yeah, I've had a beautiful steak and, a nice glass of wine and, a pint of beer. And, yeah, feeling a hell of a lot better.
Good on you, mate. Well, I reckon what we might do is, we might let you go so you can rest, get a good night's sleep, enjoy your freedom. We'll let you get a trim, clean yourself up, and maybe once you're feeling up to it, you can jump back on the show and we'll get more into detail about what you experienced. What do you reckon?
That would be great. The reception's also pretty bad at the moment. I can hear you, Blair, but Joel's breaking up on me a fair bit as well. So, yeah, a good time to jump off. But, yeah, thanks for having me on, guys, and thank you, everybody who's supported me and my wife over the last 16 weeks. It's been really appreciated. It's really helped us get through the dark times, and we've really felt the love, and we're absolutely stoked with the people who've sent letters, people who've sent donations. It's been absolutely marvelous, and I thank you all from the bottom of my heart. It's been incredible. So thank everybody who's supported us over the last 16 weeks. And yeah, I'll hope to see you when I'm back in Perth and I've had a shave and I'm back to my normal self.
God bless you, mate. Have a good night and have a safe trip home.
Thank you very much, guys. Take care.
Cheers. Well, that's just all good news, isn't it, Joel? All good news. Powerful message. Really powerful message. I love that shit. I love someone just standing up in the face of what seems like insurmountable odds, and then they prove through their own stubbornness, through their own perseverance, through their belief, they prove that they were right to do that. They come out stronger. They come out victorious. I love that shit, man. This guy's an underdog. He's a real underdog. He essentially just took on the State Police of Adelaide. He didn't let them push him out. He didn't give them what they wanted, and he won, you know?
I love all the little bits of defiance too. Like, he refuses to wear the uniform. He refuses to eat the slop and makes them boil him eggs. And he's just got that strong will. You know, you can't make this man do something he doesn't want to do. Like, you're in Stephen Wells's world. You know, like, you're not, like, he's not in your world. You're in his world. You know, you do things his way, or you ain't doing anything. You know, he's just that's the willpower. That's the defiance that we need to win. You know, that's what we have. Who's going to do 4 months in prison to prove a point for the Liberal Party? Nobody. Nobody's doing that. Nobody's doing that. But they'll do it for us because we're actually a real movement with a real purpose. And yeah,
every guy just a bunch of people
to get paid to be here. Huh?
Have you noticed every bloke you talk to who endures some sort of adversity, whether it's prison, whether he's homeless for a little while, whether he's experiencing severe financial hardship. Some guys, I suppose it's not every guy, but some guys, they just grow stronger from it. They endure, they build themselves up, and they come out better with more experience and a harder head. It's so important for men to experience adversity for that reason. And I think a lot of the time, for a lot of guys, what leads to depression or a sense of purposelessness is just not having anything to fight for, is not having the necessary adversity to overcome and to develop the confidence in themselves that they need to have as men. And I think Stephen Wells would agree with me on that one. And like I said, I'm keen to get him back on the show once he's had a rest. I can see that he's still taking it all in, and you know, he's been through so much the last 4 months. It all just must feel like a rush and a blur right now for him. And, you know, a lot of emotions, a lot to catch up on. As soon as he's decent, we'll get him back on and we'll get into this particular subject, because it's a really interesting one to unpack, how men do better in hardship a lot of the time. And when things are too easy, too simple, too comfortable, you know, men seem to actually break down. They don't really, those environments aren't suited to our nature.
Yeah, well, I mean, as the most famous quote of Friedrich Nietzsche is, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's obviously profound truth. I was actually watching the movie Kokoda the other day, and what a film. What a film, by the way. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. It should be a mandatory viewing for all Australians, really. But what I appreciate about the film is that, particularly in the first half of the film, it actually shows a lot of Aussies getting fucked up by Japs. It shows a few of them acting cowardly. It just shows like this kind of horror and confusion, because these guys were, you know, it's following the Chocos, who were not even trained, who were not really supposed to be fighting on the front lines, but the Australian army didn't get there in time. The Japanese got there and they had to make a stand before the experienced boys who we were dragging back from North Africa and Europe, were there basically. And, it's quite brutal. But then there's a few Chads that just like staunch through it and make a lot of kills and get to the end and start mowing people down. And, you know, they end up, obviously we ended up being victorious and we ended up kicking the Japs out of New Guinea. And it was an incredible underdog military victory. One of the great underdog military victories of all time in world history. But in that film, how it's depicted is they kind of depict, like, imagine being one of those guys, what they went through. And of course it's extremely horrific, but at the same time, you can't help but feel like, fuck, I wish that was me. Like at the same time, you know, like, to have experienced something like that, where you're literally, they were literally defending Australia. They were defending white Australia from the yellow menace as close as we ever got. If the Japs took New Guinea, they could have invaded Australia. You know, that was the last stand, and the chips were down, and they put up an incredible stand. And it's such a moving film. They picked all of the actors that they picked. They all had blue eyes, like every single one. They're all incredibly Australian looking. They talked with extreme Aussie accents. They just nailed it. Like it really felt authentic. And, that kind of depicts what you're saying, like in many ways, that like that was a generation that wouldn't allow the shit that is happening now to be happening to our country. They would not have allowed the country to be flooded with immigrants, especially not with, you know, niggers that commit crimes and, you know, Pajits that are sexually assaulting everyone and all the nonsense that's going on today. They simply would not have allowed that to happen. They were made of different stuff, but they were probably made of different stuff because their life was so much harder. You know, they were living at a time with less technology. A lot of them were a lot more rural. They're farmers' boys, things like that. Even if they're workers, it was in those days, you know, it was hard yakka and, you know, a lot of, you know, hard industry, things like that. You know, these weren't pussies, you know? And the thing is, pussies aren't just like, you're not just born a pussy. Like some people are just born a pussy, but a lot of pussies are made by the fact that they just simply don't have, they aren't forced to become not a pussy by circumstance. And we just don't have vehicles for that anymore. And that's a big reason why I think we're in this situation as a country, is that everyone has it too fucking easy. Everyone's playing fucking video games and watching Netflix and jacking off and eating slop from, you know, McDonald's and shit, and no one's really, you know, they're getting Uber Eats deliveries, they're going on Tinder dates, they're not Like, what's the challenge? Go to the club Friday night, pop an ecchi, have fun. Don't really think too much.
Well, the challenge is how drunk can you get? How many pills or how much ketamine can you take without actually getting brain damage? That's the challenge. I've seen men who I knew, they were in the army. And according to my understanding, they were good soldiers. And then when they leave the army, yeah, it's just Uber Eats, alcohol and drugs. And that ties back into what I'm saying and the point, the fundamental point that you're making. Men need to fight for something. They need a project to work towards every day. They need to dedicate themselves to something. If they don't have that purpose, then they just destroy themselves a lot of the time. It's a sad thing to see in Western society, but I see it all the time. And it's part of the reason I do what I do for a job, just to give people what they need to lift themselves up and start making themselves strong again, giving them a challenge that they can overcome. You know, so many people benefit from that, blokes in particular. But yeah, good shit. And I'll be glad to have him back on later. Do you want to get back into our what we were talking about before Stephen came on? What was it again? It was that article about the woman who set that guy on fire. Because I have a couple of thoughts on that, and I know that we were just about finished reading through that article, weren't we?
Yeah, there's another Nietzsche quote. In peaceful conditions, the warlike man attacks himself.
Well, that's exactly what I said, isn't it?
An aphorism. Yeah. And that's powerful. But it's real. Anyway, we were talking about that woman that doused that dude in her so-called childhood friend in petrol and set him on fire and almost killed him because he told her to get in the kitchen and make some scones. Probably as a joke too. Probably didn't even seriously mean it. I don't know. But even if he did, I mean, for fuck's sake. So, and this woman can't take responsibility. Apparently, she's the victim, really. She's got PTSD from the horrible thing that she did. So she's the real victim here.
From committing her own crime. That's part of her argument in court.
Yeah.
As a result of dousing her friend, her male friend, in petrol and then setting him on fire. And when I first heard about this story, I thought, I'll read about this because maybe it's worse than it sounds. Maybe he just burned his foot or something. I need to find out all the circumstances. But no, it was really bad. This guy received burns to 55% of his body. I think Joel went through it in the article already. He spent 74 days in the burns unit of the Alfred Hospital, 10 operations in a period of 18 months to try to fix his skin. He can never go in the sun again for the rest of his life. He's cooked. He's so cooked he couldn't even go to court to give his victim impact statement. He had to write it and email it in. And this woman who ruined his life stands in the witness box and she says, "I felt overwhelmed by his presence and his misogynistic comments, specifically that he told me I should be in the kitchen making scones, not drinking with the boys." Fair comment. Why, as a woman, would you want to drink all night with a group of men? What's going on in society where women think that that's a desirable thing to do? Why wouldn't you prefer to be making scones rather than getting shit-faced with a group of men who clearly don't respect you because they don't even respect themselves? I don't even want to drink with groups of men. Like, so why the hell would a woman want to do it? Right. So apparently they were taking cocaine as well. But what she said in the witness stand, that's what's notable. And that's what I want to get into here. I have it here. "To this day," she says, "I feel horrible for what I've done to Jake." Right. So still basically her whole attitude is still centered around how she feels. The reason she's in this mess in the first place is because everything is about how she's been made to feel. She doused the guy in petrol and set him on fire because he made her feel bad feelings. And now she's in the stand saying, "I feel horrible about this." Then she says, "I find it very hard," and this is quoted word for word. She says in the witness box, "I find it very hard to believe the injuries that were caused were from my doing." She set the guy on fire. How is it hard for her to believe that his injuries are a result of that? They're a direct result of that. And I hope she watches this. Maybe I'll make my own video to actually drive this point home, because she's going to be sentenced in the next week or two. And it's so important that she goes to jail. I can't actually believe that this woman is standing in court believing that she should walk free. after doing this to someone, right? When I was a kid, I set a garage on fire, which is arson. No one got hurt. There was barely any damage done to the property, but I knew I was going to jail. I just accepted that I was going to jail because you can't just set stuff on fire and walk free. You can't live in a community like that. I was thinking about what being let free, the broader impact or what would you call it? I suppose impact is a good enough phrase. The impact that would have on the broader community. What message does that send to the community? I can't possibly be allowed to walk free after being caught setting part of a house on fire. You can't do that. You got to go to jail for that. That's what's best for the community. That's because I'm thinking in a masculine sense or from a masculine point of view. I'm thinking not just about myself and how I feel about me going to jail. I'm thinking about how it's necessary for me to go to jail because I've been caught doing something that's pretty serious. And if I'm let off, the message that the court or judiciary sends to the community is that it's okay to set shit on fire and walk free. Obviously, they need to create deterrence and balance. That's the point of justice. Justice isn't about individual feelings or gender identity or mental health. It's not even about individuals at all. It's about society, balance and justice, what's fair and right for all of society and sending the right message. That's my understanding of justice, at least. But this woman truly believes that after setting her childhood friend on fire and destroying his life, she has instructed her lawyer to say that because of her mental health and the fact that she's a woman and mean things were said to her, causing her to feel certain feelings, she should be able to walk free after doing that. What kind of psychology allows that to be possible? To think that you can set another human being on fire and then be let off because of your mental health? And this really underlines a greater problem within our justice system, doesn't it? How certain people of certain identities, ideological persuasions, whether it's trans or gay or whether they're black or something like that, they think the law shouldn't apply to them because of that individual identity circumstance. Oh, I'm black and I come from war-torn circumstances, so I can't be held responsible for what I've done. Poor me. Look at my history. Look how I grew up. I can just rob and loot and shoot people and it's fine. I shouldn't be held responsible. I'm gay. My life's so difficult. I have depression. I'm so sad inside that what I do is not my responsibility. It's out of my hands. What kind of preposterous system of thought are we operating on in the justice system right now? And I do think it comes down, and, you know, I try not to bash on women too much, but let's be honest. It comes down to too many women writing laws in parliament and presenting as judges in the judiciary. Because how did all this start? How did we start thinking that justice should be about individual identity and not about the broader impact on all of society? It started with that obsession with the self, the inward thinking, the inability to see past one's own nose, which is the feminine way of thinking, which is not necessarily having a go at women, because women have always been more concerned with what's happening around them immediately. They've been more concerned with their children and the status of the home, whether or not the home has what it needs, is comfortable, whether the children are being fed, that kind of thing. Whereas the masculine perspective has always been, how is broader society coping with the present day situation? How safe are we as a community, as a nation? What needs to be done to ensure the safety and security of the broader community, not just one child, one woman, and one house? That's why I think laws should only be made by men. They should only be written by men with masculine perspective. And so laws should also be administered by male judges who can think about the broader implications for all of society, not just how one individual is feeling in the witness stand. That doesn't fucking matter how she feels. It doesn't matter how she identifies. It doesn't matter that she has depression. What matters is that she set a guy on fire, and that kind of behavior, especially as a result of misogynistic comments, there needs to be deterrence for that. She must go to prison. She must go to prison for a solid 10 years. Any less than that, and it just sends the wrong message. It emboldens crazy women, is she even a feminist? I don't even know if I would call her a feminist. She's a crazy bitch. That's what she is. And like I said, I want to make a video, so I hope she sees me say that. What's her name? Let's see her name here. I want to say it. Was it Corby? It was Corby Jean Walpole. Corby Jean Walpole, you're a crazy bitch. You're an absolute insane bitch. And you will be known by the internet and all of society only as being a crazy bitch. That's all you'll ever be known for the rest of your life. You belong in prison. It's no
you
one's
belong in the kitchens.
You destroyed someone's
in
life.
The fucking kitchen.
You're fucking crazy, right?
Should have just gone to the fucking kitchen. Should have just gone to the fucking kitchen and made a fucking scone, you stupid, crazy fucking bitch. You know? And let this be a lesson to all women. When I tell you to get in the kitchen, I do it out of love. I don't want you going to prison. I don't want you burning me alive and ruining your life like that. So please, just get in there. Just get in there and make me a fucking scone, sandwich, pasta, whatever the fuck's going on, right? Just get in there and fucking cook it, all right? Because, you know.
But hang on, let's get your take on the point that I was making there for a second. The point I was making was the female perspective is small and is tied up with the self and how the self feels, whereas the male perspective is less concerned with self and more concerned with the broader impact on the whole community. Is that accurate in your mind?
Yeah, facts don't care about your feelings. Ben Shapiro hyped it, but like Blair Cottrell will be way cooler than a Ben Shapiro hype. No, but yeah, seriously.
You take my question seriously, man. Come on. Is it common sense?
No, but yeah,
is this obvious, what I'm saying?
No, but it is common sense that women have an incredible difficulty in distinguishing some kind of independent reality from their emotions. That it's a much, much more difficult for women than for men. And we don't have to go into the metaphysics of why that is. That's a very large subject. I have a lot of opinions on that. We won't go there, but it's clearly true. Everyone knows that it's true. And you can get upset about it, but it's true. And sometimes it can be a great thing, right? Because what this does is it enables women to be incredibly attuned to the emotions of people who are in need of care. Like if they've got babies, children to take care of, they care so much about the feelings of their children and they kind of like block the rest of the world out. And in order for those children to be taken care of, they need another being, their mother, to be so fixated upon their well-being, they lose track of the general and focus on the particular. And the same is true for caring in many respects, right? So women hold, they're the glue that holds together the household because they kind of narrowly fixate upon the household and they block out wider society. And it's up to men to go out into wider society and handle those affairs. And that's fine if women know their place and men know their place and so on. You run into problems, though, when women try to then come into society and they're just not emotionally equipped to engage with these more general, like moral issues. So like the real issue in this case is that the magistrate that's making the decision over the sentencing is a woman. And I don't
The prosecution, I don't think she will walk free. I don't think even a female judge or magistrate, is this a magistrate? Surely this would have gone to county considering the severity. It would be at least it'd be at county, wouldn't it? But
I'm not sure what level it is.
The prosecution would need to appeal. If she gets off, man, if she walks free, the prosecution needs to appeal. I'll be on this. I want to see what's going to happen with this result. I'm following it closely. But this ties into the fact that the leader of the Liberal Party in Australia has just been named, and it's a woman, indicating that the Liberal Party has learned nothing.
Susan Ley.
Do we know anything about Susan Ley?
We know that she added an extra S to her name in order to make it more numerologically auspicious. We know that. So that's kind of interesting. We also know that back in the day, she used to have more pro-Palestine views, but then realized that she's in the Liberal Party and has been sucking Jewish dick the last few years so that she could become the leader. I first encountered her. She's been in politics for decades, but I first encountered her when we did the White Man Fight Back rally in Corowa last year, which is in her area where she's a member of parliament for. And she condemned us and attacked us. And I realized she was the deputy leader of the Liberal Party under Dutton. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't even realize this person existed. And, looking into her, she appears to be, even by the standards of the Liberal Party, quite left-wing. She's very... there was a woman who was on Sky News that described her as Malcolm Turnbull in drag, which was kind of funny. It was a rare... That one woman who said that on Sky News She's the best chick on Sky News. I remember she went on Sky News once before, and she was going on about how the Nazi symbol ban was wrong, that pagan symbols of our people, that she's a Celt, and pagan symbols of our people should not be banned, and that according to the ADL, the symbols of Celtic paganism are all hate symbols, like the Celtic cross is a hate symbol. And she was saying, and she defended the Celtic cross on the basis of her Celtic ancestry. So when you get a non-Jewish woman on Sky News, sometimes that can be all right. But I remember she used to follow me on Twitter actually before I was banned. But she said the Malcolm Turnbull in drag line, which I thought was pretty funny actually. And she, I think made the best take. But all of Sky News seems to be, even by their standards, they're like, this bitch sucks. She's like basically like a teal. She's basically like, she should be in the Labour Party. She doesn't even belong in the Liberal Party. Now she's the leader of the Liberal Party. And I've been saying the Liberal Party is a left-wing party. Everyone is under this illusion that it's a conservative right-wing party. It is conservative, I guess you could say, in a certain sense, but it's not right-wing. It's not conservative in the ideological sense. So it's a left-wing party. It's a left-wing party, and everyone needs to kind of come together and just accept that, and then we can then move forward in Australian politics. And that might seem like, whoa, that's a radical opinion. Maybe not for people watching this show, but for a lot of boomers at home who get these opinions second order because their son watches the show and then goes and, you know, harasses their dad while he's trying to watch Sky News and in kind of take in the boomer slop opinions from the Jewish matrix. This is what you need to be telling your dad. This is what you need to be telling your granddad. This is what you need to be telling your uncle. Liberal Party is a left-wing party. Liberal Party was responsible for taking away our guns. Liberal Party was responsible for institutionalizing multiculturalism in the late 70s as official policy of the Australian government. Liberal Party under Howard was responsible for radically expanding mass immigration from the third world to the kind of present historical levels, created the current historical precedent. Liberal Party legalized gay marriage. The Liberal Party are a left-wing party. They've achieved more of the left-wing's agenda in Australian political history than the Labor Party has achieved. So there's literally nothing distinguishing these two parties of significance. We saw that in the last election. Now, everyone agrees the Labour Party is a left-wing party, so how can you then therefore not view Liberal Party as a left-wing party? So it's time for so-called right-wing and conservative Australians to just make their peace with this reality and move on. Move on from Liberal Party. It's going to die. Its death is inevitable. The equivalent so-called conservative parties all across Europe are now dying. And they're dying for the same reason the Liberal Party will die. And the only reason it's still alive is because a credible, genuine, right-wing, kind of more populist alternative hasn't been presented to the Australian people to defect to. But it's inevitable that will come into existence in the coming years. And the Liberal Party will die. And so I'm stoked that Suzanne Ley is now the leader because she's an ugly old woman with no charisma, who, yeah, has negative aura. She reminds me of like a school principal or something. She's not going to be popular.
You say she's ugly? Like, is that like, you know?
Oh, okay, maybe she, I don't really, that is kind of subjective, but she's old. She's like 61, so,
In my opinion, you got to be careful throwing around, oh, this person's ugly, especially when
the Greens just put in a woman as leader, and she's not like, whoa, I'm in love, but like she's kind of like good looking, blonde, blue eyes, kind of like good looking woman. Like Liberal Party can't even put in a good looking woman. They have to put in an ugly bitch, you know, like.
That's rough, man.
An old hag. So I don't think she's going to do very well at all. Most people are predicting that she probably won't even make it to the next election. She's just, she sucks. And Liberal Party sucks, and she's the leader that they deserve. She's a representative of where the party is at. So, I look forward to her gaffes. I look forward to her terrible public speaking. And, I remember there was a clip that was going around of her saying that the X and Elon Musk need to obey the Australian e-safety commissioner and do what she says and all this kind of stuff. Like, she's a massive supporter of online censorship. She's a massive supporter of the state of Israel, even though she doesn't actually believe that because she used to be a supporter of Palestine. So she's a total fraud. She will even surrender these principles to suck the correct dicks in order to get into the correct position for her own political career. She loves Israel now because she wants to be the leader of the Liberal Party. she thinks global warming is this great threat, and she, you know, and all this kind of stuff, even though all of her voters, I mean, the reason why people vote for the Liberal Party, one of the only reasons people vote for the Liberal Party is because they expect them to not go along with the whole, you know, green agenda thing on and everything. She's got nothing. She's not going to promise to cut immigration. She's significantly more left-wing than even Peter Dutton was. So, you know, I welcome the stupidity of the Liberal Party in destroying itself.
What you're saying is under Susan Ley, it's only going to get worse with the Liberal Party, you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's she's making my argument for me.
What would the Liberal Party need to do to regain some of the votes they've lost, to regain some of the trust, popularity of the Australian people? Can they do it, or is it too late? Are they cooked?
They don't have the capability to do it or the desire to do it, so they won't do it. But obviously what they would need to do is to become an actual right-wing party.
What would be the first policy they would need to, like, what? Close the borders?
Radically cutting immigration, you know, not building wind farms everywhere, that type of thing. You know, there's only two genders, you know, all the basic stuff that conservatives believe. We don't need to have welcome to country. We don't need to be welcome to our own country. You know, you could throw white people a bone here and there without following through all the way. Like, look, in America, Donald Trump is copying your policy, Blair. I remember watching you before I knew you on Sky News many years ago advocating for white South African farmers to be priority one refugees. Well, the Trump administration did that in America, and it's been very popular on the right. Left wing is freaking out about it, and then they're going, this just proves how the left wing hate white people, and they pretend to care about refugees, but they don't actually. And it's been very effective.
Peter Dutton
agreed with you at the time. He was the Minister of Immigration, and then he got cucked by his own party. Those kinds of policies would win people over in a big way, you know, but they don't have the balls to do anything like that. So, and they don't have the will to do it. The people that actually run this party, my friends that are in the Liberal Party, I have multiple friends that are officially in the Liberal Party. Most of them are leaving now. Most of them have finally given up. I've been saying for a while that it was pointless, and they're finally coming around. And what they described to me was that inside the Liberal Party, there is something called the gays and Jews faction.
At least
and
they're calling
the gays and Jews faction are running the Liberal Party now.
How does this happen, man? How do inferior people end up in charge of people who run the country? Is it because of apathy? Too many people being disassociated from politics altogether? I know they say, I can't remember who said it, but it's a famous quote that part of the consequence of not being interested in politics is you end up being ruled by your inferiors. Is that all it comes down to? Just too many people being distracted from political process?
Yeah, I think people feel, well, there's not really a vehicle for normal people to participate in politics. Obviously, we're trying to build a vehicle
right.
for people to participate in politics, but there isn't really like a vehicle. You know, and if you become a member of the Liberal Party, you know, you're going to be very, if you have any kind of like principles, if you're a straight talker, you know, they're going to kind of, they're not going to really listen to you. They're not going to invite you to all the, you know, the special meetings, and they're not going to elevate you within the party because they're going to view you as, well, if we were to give this person an official position or listen to them, we could cause controversy in the media that's controlled by left-wing lunatics. And they might say, hey, the Liberal Party is actually right-wing. This is horrible. And then we don't want that. We want the left-wing media to not get too upset at us. That seems to be what they care about more.
Yeah.
And obviously all their donors. Like, they don't want anyone attacking immigration because they want to get money from the property lobby. And they don't want anyone pushing agendas that upset Jews because they get money from the Jews. So there's specific interest groups where they get money from.
The influence of characters like you and I on places like Twitter or X, for example, it's massively underestimated. I honestly believe that if you give someone like me, Joel, Tom Sewell, maybe free rein on X, we could potentially be more influential in this country than Channel 7, Channel 9, and Channel 10 put together. So if you invest in influencers like us and actually allow us to use social media freely, like you do what you can to prevent censorship, we become the media that's promoting your politics, your party. And you'll get far. Your message will get far and wide. But there's still so much faith in this old legacy media process in so many of these old parliamentarians. They still think they have to dance to the tune of the mainstream media. No longer is that the case, but they're just unwilling to accept the shift the social media and the internet has created in society, which gives all the power, all the social power, the power of propaganda to people like us if you give us free rein, right?
Yeah, and that's the other thing. They can't really produce their own organic, like, conservative influences that are interesting because they're so neutered and they're not even really conservative. Like, in America, they're a lot more capable of doing that because they at least, like, throw a bone to people like us. You know, you've got Elon Musk throwing Romans and the white South African refugees and mass deportations now. You know, they're pushing at least some of the shit that we push in a kind of, like, kind of take it with the edge taken off, obviously. Yeah. And they're able to therefore energize their voters and energize, you know, white identitarians and so on around their message in a way that's actually effective. Now, I don't want that to happen here. I want what's happening now to happen here. I want the Liberal Party to cuck out extremely hard, because what that enables us to do is to build our own movement, which is going to be actually representing our values rather than basically having a conservative movement that pretends to agree with us, to hoodwink us into support, making certain concessions, but ultimately not implementing the changes that are necessary and therefore pacifying the population and pacifying you know, the concerns that we speak to that otherwise aren't being spoken to. So what's happening now is actually going to produce a more revolutionary outcome, because the political system is not is just trying to, like, lock out people like us and the concerns we represent. That won't ultimately work. What they need to do, if they're smart, is what they're doing in America or what they're doing in some European countries, create a Zionist approved you know, cucked version of us, promote the shit out of it, and then convince people, hey, like, you know, what radicals like Joel Davis wants, like, that's unrealistic, but this is realistic, this is viable, get behind this, and we could actually implement real change. And, you know, that's a message that they could still sell to a lot of people, because they are risk averse and they want the easy way out. But right now, Australian politics isn't actually able to provide an easy way out. So when we come along and provide maybe the more hard way out, but at least an interesting, genuine, real opposition movement, I think this is perfect, fertile ground for us to grow. So that's why I love what they're doing. I love the ridiculousness of these people. I don't want them to change and start taking my advice. That's why I actually, you know, I endorse Susan Ley for leadership, because I know there's nothing that, you know, red-blooded patriotic Aussies love more than some, like, school mom bitch, you know, talking down to them. So I know that it's going to work out great for them.
We're so underutilized. Our influence is so, I'm so underutilized. I'm not even that extreme compared to some of the other guys in the fringe these days. And I'm still locked out as well. Like, I can't even film my little commentary videos, which are always very fair. You know, I'm always very reasonable. I don't go too hard. I don't carry on too much. But I'm completely underutilized because there's no actual right-wing party that's willing to make use of the sort of influence that I can generate. For me, generating influence online is relatively easy. I know how people think and I know how to put content together. It's simple. And I know what kind of stories and what people want to hear about and how to present the information to them. It's not difficult. But instead, I'm just sitting in this corner with all the Nazis and giving all of my, you know, assistance to them because I'm completely locked out of the political fight because I'm too extreme and it's not allowed. The things that I say or believe in, they're not allowed. So, yeah, again, as you said, it's just going to produce a more revolutionary outcome because
they made us into
it. To help the Nazis. Just in the same fashion that I'm forced to help the Nazis, that's where my talents have to go. People are going to end up being forced to vote for the Nazis too, because that's all they'll be. That's the only alternative, the viable alternative, which will exist, right?
Well, exactly. And Thomas, myself, we didn't start out here. Like, we got convinced to go here because we realized that only the level of absolute ideological determination that Nazis have is going to be sufficient to withstand the pressure that is being kind of placed upon us by the state, and in order to basically struggle against the forces of modernity, struggle against the forces of corruption, and, you know, through sheer willpower, force a pro-white, a radical pro-white movement into existence. that basically is strong enough to be able to exist and fight back against such a repressive system. If they allowed when you guys were doing the UPF thing, if they allowed you to do that, that would be the thing. That would have turned into a political party. It would now be the big populist right-wing party. You guys were more moderate back then. You were more compromising.
It'll be a more controllable type of conservative thing. It'll be pretty right-wing. And as long as I stayed at the center of it, I'd make sure it was as pure as possible. But it wouldn't be as steadfast. It wouldn't be as impenetrable as an actual National Socialist Revolution. Of course not, because it would have to abide by parliamentary democratic standards, and there's all sorts of red tape, ins and outs that you've got to sort of...
You were meeting the people more where they were at, where like we're going, okay, well, we can't do that. They're not going to allow us to meet the people where they're at. So now we're going to have to force the people into a polarity against you, like in a far more extreme way. That's now what we've been forced to do. So it's their fault that we exist and that we're going about things in this way.
So in summary, if you don't allow any sort of genuine right-wing option, you're essentially down the road empowering the Nazis.
Well, yeah. But anyway, there's another story that I thought we could cover, which is that I'm seeing Ralph Babbitt is saying that he's going to sue Devere Abramovich, which is quite funny.
That'd be excellent. I hope. In relation to what? What has Devere Abramovich said about
it? So, Ralph Babbitt said that he liked the Kanye West Heil Hitler song. And then Devere Abramovich went into the media and did his typical thing, accusing him of being a Nazi and saying that he's justifying genocide and the Holocaust and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And then Ralph Babbitt said, well, his interpretation of the song is that it's not glorifying National Socialism, but that it's actually depicting Hitler as the villain and Kanye West is kind of ironically identifying as the villain because of his social alienation. And so he says that from his view, that's not what the song's connotation was. And so that he's saying that he's being defamed and that he's going to look into, you know, his legal options to try and get compensation from Devere Abramovich and the so-called Anti-Defamation Commission, which is the name of his organization. So he's going to sue the Anti-Defamation Commission for defamation.
For defamation. Yeah, isn't that ironic?
Which is long overdue. And I support Caramel Power, Ralph Babbitt, in his exercise in extracting wealth out of the Jewish menace. That's quite funny.
He's a good sport, Babbitt. I can tell you that this is not an isolated case, too. There's a couple of people who are in the process of filing lawsuits against a couple of media publications for similar defamation or claims of defamation. And it's great because there needs to be precedent there. If you can keep these people in check, if you can make them a little bit tentative about what they write and how they phrase things, then it limits the kind of negative impact that they can have on the general public in regards to our image.
Yeah, so anyway, let's get into a couple of super chats. I was sent a Bitcoin super chat where someone sent me some Bitcoin in my Bitcoin wallet.
Yeah, you showed me that, and I was like, I thought you said it was 100 Bitcoin, but I think it's $100 in Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah, I wish it was 100. It's 100 Bitcoin.
Someone sent us 100 Bitcoin.
I'd be funding the movement in a big way going forward. I'd be dumping that. That'd be like, that's like 10 million US.
But that's not what we got, right? We got $100 in
Bitcoin. Yeah, please send me 100 Bitcoin and I will mainstream National Socialism in Australia. Send me 100 Bitcoin,
on this
please.
Subject, before
one of these crypto billionaires.
Before you read the question out, on this subject, Telegram, on my Telegram channel, Telegram forces ads onto my channel and I can't see them or control what sort of ads Telegram's putting on there. But then they say they share part of the profit for the ad revenue with you, but they share it with you in what's called TON, which is some sort of fake currency, like maybe a cryptocurrency or a token. I think it's like an online token currency. And I've got it in a wallet or something. I extracted like $40 worth of TON or something, but I don't know how to translate that into actual money that I can use. Is it even possible? If you know the answer to this question, hit up my direct messages on Telegram.
I know the answer to the question. I know you shouldn't ask me.
All right. Well, maybe I should have.
It's not that complicated. But yeah. Anyway, we'll read out the super chat. He asked me four questions. His name is G-Force. He's from the Netherlands. He said, why do so many sons, like Don Black's or William Luther Pierce's, reject their father's values? I don't know about Don Black's children, but I do know that William Luther Pierce's son is a libtard, which is unfortunate. Do you have thoughts on this, Blair? Why, you know,
my immediate thought about William Luther Pierce's son is it depends. It depends on a number of factors. You see, if William Luther Pierce was a little bit too forceful with his son when he was growing up, that can produce an opposite effect to the desired one. Obviously, children get a little bit rebellious, and if you're going to be ranting at them too much and banning them from doing certain things or watching certain things, then obviously they're going to want to do and watch those things that you're banning them from doing and watching. So you've got to be careful how forceful you are with your children, how strict you are. It's good to have principles and to help your children understand what's good and what's bad, but you need to help them understand through their own observations, on their own accord and on their own terms. Don't try to force them to do or not do things, because you'll often produce, as I said, the opposite result. That could have been a little bit at play. It also could have been that his son, William Luther Pierce's son, doesn't want to sort of go out the same way his father did. Maybe his father had a pretty rough experience. I know that he started up a separatist community, didn't he? What was it called again?
I don't remember what it was called. I think it still exists in some form.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Maybe it didn't do so well. Maybe his father experienced adversity that maybe he's scared to experience. There might be a bit of that involved. Maybe he got stood over. You know what I mean? Maybe he's got the feds up his ass and he doesn't really want to take any risks. I don't know, man. There's probably a number of factors at play there. What do you reckon?
I think the relationship between a boy and a father is something which reaches its most important point in the early teens, mid-teens, where the boy is developing his individuality and is looking to the father for an example. And if the father is not able to provide a solid example, you can get a kind of defiant reaction where there's a repudiation of the father's values, a radical repudiation, a kind of rebellion that then occurs. So perhaps there's something personal there, like, I don't know, all the specifics of, you know, what was happening, whether they were estranged or what. But I would speculate that kind of thing, if it wasn't the case in the case of William Luther Pierce, is still something that is real. It's something one must be conscious of when you're raising boys, that, you know, you have to kind of win your son over to your values through exemplary conduct, making them feel secure in your example, that you know what you're doing, you know where you're going, and that you're a good man who's doing your duties. And but yeah, maybe his son was a faggot who sided with his mother against him. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know the situation there. So how could I speculate on the specifics? But
exactly, it's difficult. But I can say, yeah, for example, tying into what I was just talking about before, if you're, for example, sitting on the couch and you're watching a Netflix movie with your son and you see like an obvious case of race placement where an historical European, maybe like someone significant to our history, is depicted by a black person or something like that, or you see two gay people that, you know, were slotted into the story and it just didn't need to be there, it's not adding anything to the story, it's obviously kind of social engineering, it's propaganda. You kind of just make little exclamations. You don't rant about it too much, but even if your son says something that, why do you have a problem with this, dad? You know, that kind of thing. You can say little things like, just be careful, mate. People will try to make you think that evil stuff or bad things are normal. So just be careful out there, yeah? Not everything you see is what it seems. Little one-liners like that. I remember my dad giving me one-liners. He never ranted at me, my dad. He never made many rules. He wouldn't even speak that much, but when he did speak, I would listen. And it was always just little one-liners like, just be careful with what they tell you in that school, you know? Just be careful watching that show you're watching. You know, I noticed some pretty twisted shit in there, so just be careful. He would say things like that, you know? Keep your wits about you. Don't believe everything they tell you on that show. And I'd be like, oh, you know? And I'd think about it myself. And then I knew that my father expected me to make the right choice, expected me to pay attention, expected me to discern correctly with what I was receiving, the information I was receiving. And I think that's a powerful way to influence your children. Just little one-liners and let them make up their own minds. Even if they make mistakes, let them make mistakes and learn through their mistakes. That's the way I was raised anyway.
In Jungian psychoanalysis, the concept of the anima and the animus, which are basically unconscious forms of like the masculine and the feminine form in the unconscious, which we all have according to Jungian psychoanalysis, we tend to project, particularly the form with which we don't identify. So men will tend to project their anima upon the mother, then on women that they're in romantic relationships with, and men will, and vice versa. But there's still a process of projection, I think, that occurs, in Jungian psychoanalysis, particularly in your youth, with the one that you identify with. And what the way Jung describes the anima and the animus is that the anima, the feminine, is the life force. And if you think about, what it does the feminine provide? The feminine provides life itself. Like the feminine is the ground of life through like maternity, whether it be through like literally giving birth, through breastfeeding, through nurturing, and so on. Whereas the animus is the logos, the ordering principle. What does the father provide? The father provides rules, direction, structure. And this is a trope that is common in various psychological theories. In like Lacanian psychoanalysis, for example, you see a similar dichotomy in this, in others. The point is that what you're fundamentally looking for in a mother is not necessarily direction, moral direction, life direction. What you're looking for is just care. Your mom's got to be just like there for you to help you. Whereas what you're looking for in a father is meaning. What does my life mean? Who am I supposed to be? What are my like responsibilities and obligations? And when I think about, a friend of ours, Jim Roberts, who's in the organization, he talks about his father, who's no longer with us, unfortunately. He talks about his father with great esteem. He's like, "Oh, my old man said this, and my old man did that." And he's always got. Now, his dad was a skinhead, by the way, so he definitely continued on in his father's values. But he speaks about his father's wisdom with this kind of in this like glowing way, like his father provided this really important direction to him in his development. And that's an example of that, and some people you see, they have that very strong where they kind of really lean on their father's wisdom quite explicitly. Others, maybe they experience father figures outside of their actual father. Maybe they go out and look and find great figures in history, or they have a mentor in some respect that they meet through sport or education or whatever that they can kind of map onto and develop a sense of what their meaning, purpose, and role in life. And obviously what happens if someone does completely repudiates their father's value system is that the father was not able to do that, was not able to perform that function, and so they had to look elsewhere and they modeled themselves off others. Every young person is always looking for examples to model themselves off. And so if you're going to embody, you have to embody your values. Can't just believe them, I think is the key point. And you have to embody them in the relationship, not just like in the outward way that you act. So I think like, the reason why he asked me this question, this individual sent a super chat, is I believe he's one of his sons is with a woman that he's no longer in a relationship with. And I guess he's concerned. He said here, how do you raise sons to say loyal to our worldview and protect masculine bonds once we're in relationships? Basically, obviously, he's saying he's in a relationship with another woman now, and can serious activism be balanced with raising a family? And obviously, these questions are interlinked. He must be having anxieties about the fact that his son is living in, his mother's home outside of his influence, and that's obviously compounding the difficulty in this respect. I don't know enough, obviously, about the particulars, but what I would say is that, in particular, when the boy comes of age, it's very important to, I think, spend a lot of one-on-one time that focuses upon his personal areas of development. So like, is your kid into martial arts? My sons are going to be forced to be into martial arts, frankly. Be involved, be there, train with your kid. You know, embody the values that you want your kid to have. Yeah, if you want your kid to be reading certain books and to be engaging with certain ideas, you need to show how, in the sense that through your engagement with certain ideas, you're setting the example of the value and virtue of doing so, where your son can be proud to be your son because of what you've achieved. So when you say, can serious activism be balanced with having a family? It definitely creates difficulties. But if you can achieve something that's admirable, then your son is going to be more likely to take pride in the things that you've achieved, I would say, in general. But obviously it's difficult. You know, there's a lot of people in this who have kids that we associate with, and the way in which they deal with it that I observe is through having a very strong community. All the families close together, the kids kind of growing up together, spend a lot of time together, a big community supporting each other with shared values. That enables, I think, the values to seep into the next generation, because kids also get a lot of their values, not from the parents, but from their friends. You know, when I was a kid, my peers were probably more important to my development in many respects than my parents, because when you're with your parents, you're subject to an authority figure. You can't truly be yourself. You've got to kind of be subject to them. Whereas when you're playing with other kids, when the adults aren't around, that's when you can experiment. That's when you can assert yourself. That's when you can kind of like see when there's no one looking at you, you can see what you can get away with. You can, and then you end up having to like develop your own little society or whatever. And that actually is more.
You should still understand the temporary nature of friends, though. Friends always leave eventually, and family remains. So you enjoy yourself with friends, and you discover yourself through friends in a number of ways. You develop a personality that sometimes mimics a version of elements of character that you absorb from your friends, but they always move on. They're never there forever. So it's important to remember that. But
that's true. But I mean, the point though, you want your kids playing with other kids that are from Nazi families, basically. Like, that's the long and short of it. Like,
but you said earlier, you said that you tend to, or young men in particular, they model themselves on characters or figures, and they basically try to absorb values or even copy those characters and figures. Did you do that? And if so, can you remember the first three men or characters that you admired or tried to take something from?
Not really. I don't think there was any like specific when I was like a teenager. I liked rock stars. Tried to emulate.
I see that you got kind of like rock star vibes about you when you get around, even how you dress a little bit, maybe. But for me, it was Arnold. Obviously, Arnold, the big bodybuilder, loved his movies when I was a kid. My dad would let me stay up late and watch Arnold movies. And the second was probably Vegeta from Dragon Ball Z. I really admired Vegeta's pride and his tenacity. And the third was probably Chopper Reed. They were the first three characters that I really took an interest in and admired. And I even tried to sort of like absorb some of what I was seeing and learning from them. I found them really interesting and admirable for different reasons. Chopper Reed, not so much admirable, but definitely interesting, especially when he was younger. His way of interpreting the situation or the environment around him was really autistic, and probably one of the first criminal autists that got airtime with mainstream media, I think, in Australia anyway. But yeah, they were the three that sort of grabbed my attention.
The archetypes that often appeal to me is kind of like the wise old man archetype, but I'm not really like at that phase of life yet, you know, but eventually everything will probably turn white and I'll become like a Gandalf, like a kind of Nazi Gandalf. You know, I'm looking forward to that, like wise old man.
Stephen Wells has already beat you to it, mate.
Well, yeah, well, he's leading the way. You know, I'm not there yet, but you know, I want to get there one day. I look forward to that. A lot of people don't look forward to old age. I actually look forward to the kind of wise old philosopher sorcerer archetype. You know,
I look forward to being able to be an asshole and get away with it. Just, you know, be a grumpy old man, take my time, get in people's way. You know, not really do I look forward to that so much, but you know, there's certain privileges that old people get that. I can't visualize myself as an old man. I don't know. Maybe I have a young spirit or a young streak in me, but
trying. By the way, if you are old, do older women become more attractive when you get older, or is it coke?
I don't think so, man. I've spoken to older guys. Old enough, I've asked them this question. I've asked older guys this question. I said, basically, I asked, does it get any easier? does that the desire for women, does it start to subside as you get older? And these are guys who are like in their 80s, man. And they said, no, if anything, it gets worse. It's like, I didn't ask them specifically about the old lady question.
Well, but, that's what I'm asking about.
I know.
Because I can't imagine having sex with an old woman. But old people have sex, apparently. So, like, they just... What else is there to do? Or, like, do you, like, develop an appreciation? If you're an old guy, super chat the show, send in, or you don't have to necessarily super chat, but just...
Yeah, to be honest, I think old people are together for ages. They love each other, man. So I would say just out of that spiritual bond, definitely. Because when you're an old guy, right, let's say you've been married for like 50 years, you're looking at your 73-year-old wife, you would still see the woman you married 50 years ago. You would still see her.
But apparently in old people's homes, they're all fucking each other. So
surely not.
I've talked to people that are working in the old people's homes.
Oh my
god. It's a fuck fest in there. It's out of control.
Maybe we should change the subject. It's starting to get a little bit low.
Look, this is a real thing. I'm just saying I'm not saying this is what I want it to be. I'm not saying this because I'm taking a pleasure in old people having orgies in the old people's home. I'm just telling you what every single person I've spoken to who works in old people's homes have ever told me. They all tell me this.
I've heard it myself as well. I just haven't really thought about it very much.
Anyway, if you're an old fart, let me know. Do the women get better? Because if they don't, you know, maybe I have to martyr myself for the white race, because I don't know if I really want to be, if old women are as undesirable as they are now when I'm an old guy. Maybe, yeah, I don't want to say anything.
That's so mean. I have heard, you got to be careful if you're working for NDIS and you're caring for old guys in particular, or even just people with disabilities. I have heard that you got to be careful, because a lot of the time they act oblivious, but they're just perverts and they're always trying to cop a feel or something. So there's a lot of like deranged sex perverts that are posing as disabled or really old guys who need help. And they're deliberately selecting all the young female carers on the NDIS app because they're just trying to, like, you know, take advantage of the situation. So you've got to be careful out there if you're a woman working for NDIS.
Anyway, let's. Sector 88 said, "Greater love hath no man than this." And that's obviously, it comes from Christ, but it's also an inscription on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in the Shrine of Remembrance, and it's a beautiful sentiment for the sacrificial love, whether it be, you know, in the example of Christ, or whether it be in the example of the incredible men who laid down their lives to fight for white Australia. When I watched that movie Kokoda, I felt very strongly, we can't fucking lose. How many fucking men went and got butchered by Japs in some fucking forest jungle, you know, to protect white Australia? We just throw it away? Are you fucking kidding me? All the men that rushed the beaches at Gallipoli, thousands dead within 2 days. What, we're just going to throw it away? They were fighting for a white Australia. That's why they were willing to run up that beach and take a bullet to the heart. It just can't be given away. Like, there's too many men have died for this. Canadian Girl Rumble said, "Fantastic video, epic edits, got everyone hyped." I think she's talking about the documentary. And it was excellent. I think everyone agrees on that.
That's really kind. Still getting a lot of appreciation from our Canadian cousins, I see.
Yeah, I think the Canadians in particular seem to resonate with us. I think they feel a certain affinity. Similarity, I think they kind of get us more than most other countries do.
We're not as cringe as Americans, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to go on an anti-America rant.
Hey, I love Americans. Come on, man. I love America.
I love Americans. I don't know if I love America, but Homer the Brave said, "Whoever gave the speech, we're going to make them see just how long our memories really are." That hit hard. from a man on the other side of the world. I share that memory with you, Harold the White Man. Yeah, that was Gus. Gus's speech was good. It went hard. He did a great job.
Man of passion.
He smashed the speech. What else have we got? Anyone else sending super chats? You guys are all cheap cunts tonight. Barely any
you
super
want your
chats.
Super chat read out. If you want it read out, you got to send it through now, guys. You got 2 minutes.
Right for White said on Entropy, tell Callahan and Crazy Hat Gentleman on Odyssey to stop fighting, lol. They need a kiss and make up. Well, honestly, I've been neglecting the Odyssey chat, so I don't know what they're doing in there. But, you know, whatever. Bluey Waffen said, the left wing has an uncanny ability to create a crisis out of nothing and whip themselves into a frenzy over it. The right hasn't been able to emulate that to any great extent. I think the right is getting better in recent years in terms of like moral outrage. Like, for example, that welcome to country reaction that was provoked, you know, there was a pretty good kind of like, you know, emotional response to that. And there was, you know, I do feel like there's increasing moral fortitude in the right. But the thing is that hysteria is a very feminine and leftist trait. I don't think the right is going to ascend through hysteria. It's going to be through anger, righteous anger, but I don't think it can
hysterical come through. Hysterical anger, maybe?
I don't think it can come through hysterical anger. I think we have to take a bit of a different approach. We're temperamentally different. So
that's true.
You know, part of the reason why people hate the left is they recognize their hysterical nature and go, well, those are obviously the retards of the political
spectrum. Would you say that we're more calculated?
I don't know if we're necessarily more calculated, but less emotional.
We're more individualistic, but that's caused problems as well.
Mm.
I don't know. We're definitely less emotional. That's why we don't fly into hysteria. We're willing to tolerate too much. And in some ways that can be a virtue, but these days it's really not. The less
it's
you
not
tolerate
a virtue politics. We've talked about this on the show before. Remember, I had that point that where I said the psychological attributes that make you a good person are completely antithetical to the psychological attributes that make you an effective political activist group.
Yeah.
So
I said this too. I wrapped it up in the way I summarized it was you have to be a bad guy in politics. You can't be the good guy.
Yeah. But look at how Jews and leftists weaponize the absolute worst possible personality traits in confluence with one another to great effect. You know, they're resentful, they're hysterical, they're vengeful.
The tools in our hands makes me think of the Protocols of Zion. The tools in our hands are unrelenting hatred and a bunch of other things, but they brag at one point about being able to use extreme hatred as a political tool to manipulate the nations of the world.
Yeah. I see Homer the Brave said, is Gus or any of the other boys on X, or is it like official Aussie policy that none of you can speak on the app? Well, the government is trying to, I think, is obviously involved in some way in getting us banned from Twitter. But yeah, Gus does exist on the app. I don't want to say what his Twitter account is because I'm afraid if I identify him, he might get taken down. But it's not our policy that our members can't speak on social media. They're all free to speak as much as they want. We do have a distinction between official spokespeople, though, and there's people that can be a member of the org and they can say whatever they want, but they're not official spokespeople, let's say.
It's not for everyone, too. Not everyone wants to be a social media guy. I mean, maybe they will at some point in the future, but it takes a certain type of personality to want to, like, you know, film yourself, broadcast your opinions to millions of people across the world. It's, you know, not everyone wants to do that. So,
yeah, exactly. But look, I think we're just going to end the show there. I hope everyone enjoyed the show this evening. Touching moment having Stephen Wells on. It was nice. It was nice to have him on. Nice to see him out of prison. And yeah, big win, I guess. You know, with the police dropping all these charges, I'm a little bit disappointed. I wanted to go to the High Court, but I guess it'll be good when the charges are dropped. We'll get rid of the bail conditions. We'll be able to have Tom back on the show. We'll be able to have Jacob on the show like normal, like it was before, where we can. So that'll be good. I'll be able to do NSN rallies. and all kinds of shit. So it'll be good. It's a good thing. And it's also just egg on the face of South Australia police. And also, might I add, notice how the mainstream media have not covered that these charges have been dropped.
Mm.
That's quite interesting.
They did a lot of reporting about the charges being placed on you, but nothing about them being dropped.
Yeah, and they covered the other court dates where we were arguing about bail conditions and all that kind of thing. So they were covering all of those.
You know, right, it's a victory. They don't want to acknowledge that you've had a victory.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it makes perfect sense because so long as they're covering police harassment or the police getting it over you, they're arresting you, they're charging you, then they're having the effect of general deterrence on the community. Regular people are like, oh, well, I don't want to get involved in this because then I'll be arrested and charged too. And then when you're at court, they're covering it because you're still tied up in court. You're still dealing with the same situation months later. But then when you get off, when you walk away scot-free, they're not interested in reporting that because it makes it look like there's no consequence for this kind of activism. And like I said, it also looks like a bit of a victory. Looks like a failure on the part of the state to actually hit you with charges that will stick and doesn't have the same deterrent effect. It makes perfect sense why they wouldn't cover it.
Yeah, it does. It's important to notice. But, of course, the noticer covered us, so you can go and read noticer.news. You can find actually good coverage of what's been happening, what's going to be happening if you're following the case further. We'll be back next week with another stream. And this stream, we kind of were talking about ourselves a lot because we're the most interesting story in this stream, but we'll probably do a bit more of a cerebral analytical stream next week, pending interesting events that force us to do a similar stream to this, I guess. But I hope you enjoyed this evening. This show was more about vibes because it feels vindicating with the combination of the release of the documentary and also all these charges being dropped. It feels vindicated that what we did on Australia Day was absolutely correct and successful. And, you know, a lot of people were saying, oh, you know, you're getting yourself arrested and thrown in prison. How's that going to save the white race and all this kind of shit? Well, we're not fucking going to prison. Getting arrested doesn't mean shit. Who cares about getting arrested? We're not going to prison. So at least not over this. So what we did was we showed defiance at a time when it was brutally necessary and we exposed a corrupt tyranny to our own people on our national holiday. It was an incredible successful operation from an activistic standpoint. We have a really cool documentary out of it. And yeah, watch the fucking documentary, spread the documentary, share it on Twitter, shill it in the replies of politicians, shill it in the replies of right-wing influencers, you know, get eyes on it. Follow White Oz Media on X so you can find the documentary. I think Comfy Friend posted it as well, friend of the show. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it all over the place. So watch the doco, spread the doco, spread the love.
Been a good show. Been a real good show. Thanks, guys, for joining us. It was great to talk to Stephen Wells. It's great to have him out free. Really great result. Powerful message by Stephen, too. And looking forward to getting Stephen back on the show maybe next week or maybe sooner, depending on how he's feeling. Thanks for joining us. And thanks again to everyone who supported Stephen Wells, whether you donated, you sent him a letter. Thanks for your passion. Thanks for your belief. Thanks for your support. I'm sure it means a lot to Stephen, but it means a lot that the community gathers behind people who are in situations like that. So thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
That was important at the time too, because Stephen's, I'm just going to say this, Stephen's wife was freaking out about how she was going to pay the bills. Because Stephen, basically his job fired him. There was no money coming in. They had mortgage to pay, et cetera. And she was freaking out about what she was going to do. And then the boys in Western Australia, they set up a fundraiser. We shared it around. The people were very generous. And they put her at ease and helped galvanize both of them to make their point. And now Stephen's going home and everyone's going home happy. So it's nice to have a community that rallies around. I remember when the police raided last year and they seized a whole bunch of people's devices. They seized their laptops, cameras, expensive equipment that we used for, you know, our production and things like that with, you know, our propaganda. We put out a fundraiser. People were generous then. We put out a few fundraisers. People have been generous. So we really do appreciate that because, you know, it's a grassroots political movement. So it's kind of dependent upon your support, and we appreciate it. But, yeah, we'll end it there. See you next week.